2012. It's Friday. Friday on the front porch, as it appears to be the dead of winter now again back here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West Virginia. We're expecting to see something like 5 inches of snow by this time tomorrow. About 2, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 miles up the road where the altitude doubles, it'll probably be closer to a foot. At least that's what's supposed to be happening this time of year. It's been rather of a busy day around here. We now have officially have a new internet service provider in an effort to become a much leaner, more cost-effective operation. Cross your fingers. All the phones work. Here, let's check just for fun. Yeah, that's definitely a dial tone. The phones work, with a caveat. And the caveat is this. The toll-free number is gone. So when I give out the number and I say, and toll-free, blah, 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 just remember that's gone because I'll forget and I'll say it anyway. Yeah. I don't know that it's gone forever, but it's going to take... You know, all the old reliables out there are gone now. MCI's gone. Sprint's not in the long-distance business anymore. So it's going to take a little bit of digging around and working to find a toll-free solution. But we will. We will. Assuming that it's not prohibitively expensive. So just going forward, and it probably won't change when we get the new number. But just going forward, remember... that the direct dial number is what works now. Area code 304-658-3333. And, you know, some of this is a response to issues we've had with fundraising. It's just what it is. It doesn't mean that we're going out of business. It's not like when a restaurant changes its menu or something. It just means that we have to get a little more conscious, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. But we will bring back the toll-free number. And hopefully, among other things, those of you who have been so kind along the way, say, Bob, stream's down when the rerun stream was going. Hopefully that won't be happening anymore either. Cross your fingers. I've been testing the system all day long, and it seems to hold up to just about anything I subject it to. So we find ourselves at a rather chilly and gray Friday on the front porch on the Horn. By all means, come on up and underneath the infrared lamps. And instead of swilling on the hooch this evening, I have something of which I am very, very fond. I've got a steaming cup of bean soup. Yeah, that'll make, and it doesn't even have ham hock stuff in it or bacon or anything. I don't like the vegetarians in the crowd very happy for me. Agnes fixed a huge pot of my very favorite legume. It's a bean called the Mayacoba, M-A-Y-A-C-O-B-A. The Mayacoba, cultivated in the Valley of Mexico for, 3, 4, 5, 10,000 years, something like that. and it's about as big. It's bigger than a pinto, but smaller than a cranberry or October bean, and it's golden in color. And oh, the flavor is just wonderful. And so I've got a steaming hot cup of bean soup with no cornbread, by the way. Bean soup with salt and pepper and a few blasts of Cholula in it just to give it a little bit of oomph. So there we have it. Wow, thank you very kindly. Thank you very kindly for the early contribution. That means we are one Thrifty 250 contribution away from tonight's fundraising. And I should let you know that it is time for this month's challenge from our good friend Dr. John in New York. He wrote in earlier today and said, listener challenge time. He said, "Hey, Bob, I'd like to offer a challenge to the Horn family on the next broadcast. I'll match the first $50 in contributions, the first $50, dollar for dollar. Here's a chance to double your Thrifty 250 contribution and keep the Horns lights on and mic hot." And that's exactly what it is. So we are already one to the good on that. John, thank you very much. Yay, you made it, says Jack. Yay, you're there. You know, I'm much more excited when y'all are there than when I am here, if that makes any sense at all. So, you know, with my mug of peppery, salty, Cholula hot saucy bean soup. Good. And with a newly redesigned telephone system that we will, I trust, test in short order, but with no toll-free service, we will assay into this Friday on the front porch. And how and where? Well, I'm sure that those who are absolutely convinced that Barack Obama has little horns growing out of his head and his and cloven hooves and a little tail tucked down his trouser legs will discount this, but still, this is a good step forward. It looks like you remember No Child's Behind left, right? That god awful piece of education deviltry that was foisted off on us, and somehow or another poor Ted Kennedy got duped into participating in it. It was a system that was designed to create, and just like everything else in the Bush administration, that was designed to create failure in public institutions. Just as the Bush tax cuts were designed to a priori to destroy the American economy, and just as most of the things that the Bush administration did not have direct real-world consequences until he was long gone from office. Well, No Child's Behind left was designed that way, too. Because No Child's Behind left was designed to not so much make schools fail, but to make sure that they couldn't succeed. It created a sort of downward spiral hole for struggling schools to go through. And the Obama administration has been fairly clear in stating that it wants No Child's Behind left fixed, that it wants a functional public education system in this country. But what is a president to do when the House of Representatives is controlled by a bunch of madcap jokers sitting and arguing, as I think it was Albert who pointed it out, arguing over butter, which side of the bread to butter, a la the Mad Hatter's Tea Party? What's a president to do when that's the Congress he's got to deal with? Well, the White House has made an announcement that the first states to receive waivers on No Child's Behind left are Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oklahoma, Stan, and Tennessee. New Mexico is very close to finishing its application. 28 other states have expressed interest in seeking a waiver as well. And what this waiver does is allow states to implement their own reforms instead of meeting the impossible standards established under No Child Behind Left. Those standards applying to mathematical and reading proficiency by the 2014 deadline, which really was kind of a drop-dead date under No Child Behind Left. These waivered states that I mentioned a minute ago are going to be able to implement broader plans to prepare students for college and careers. In other words, instead of teaching the test, they're going to be able to teach the subject matter. Now, President Not Sure said, "The goals of No Child Left Behind were the right ones, but we need to do it in a way that doesn't force teachers to teach to the test or encourage schools to lower their standards to avoid being labeled as failures." So hopefully this will actually result in a step back from disaster for a lot of public schools in this country. And oddly enough, it plays it has a how's a wingnut to respond to that? That's state control, you know, because they're all remember one of the departments that Rick Goodhair Perry couldn't remember that he wanted to get rid of, wasn't one of those the Department of Education? This is a beautiful little example of the damned if you don't, damned if you do world that President Obama occupies. Now here he is, he has extended state control into No Child Behind Left. Right? Left, right. Get it? And that's generally in keeping with the stuff that the conservatives and teabaggers and such like that, you know, can misspell their signs and stuff, say that they want. So far, so good. Are we on the same page? Good. Well, I offer you the words of Repiglican Senator Mike Enzi. Now, the Reverend Moon-owned Washington Times quotes him as arguing, Mike Enzi, Repiglican from Wyoming, arguing that the Obama administration's overreached its authority. And that one has politicized education policy, and he's playing a political poker chip. Huh? What? If you ever wanted an example of Barack Obama saving kittens and being accused of, really? Because if the man was climbing trees and burning trees and saving kittens, the Repiglican right and some on the so-called left would, well, see, that just proves he's another goddamn fascist just like Bush. And this is an example of that. There's very little a president can do without the cooperation of Congress. I am by no means an apologist for Barack Obama, but dadgum if I don't understand the spot he's in. A president has significant limitations upon his abilities, and you do what you can where you can. In this case, through the Department of Education, he's offering waivers on No Child Behind Left so that schools don't just have to be declared failures so that the, well, you know what we need to do is we need to close them damn public schools and give some waivers to the little Catholic schools and the fundamentalist big hair all the way up to Jesus schools and get education back in the hands of religion where it began, quoth Jerry Falwell as referenced last night. This is an actual and earnest statement that public education is something that's actually beneficial. Hopefully. So, just that as something to think about. Something worthwhile. But it's Friday on the front porch, and there's always a component of stupidity. Well, come on, we talk about right-wingers Monday through Friday, so there's always an element of stupidity on this program. And beyond, you know, beyond that opening story, I'd like for us to have a little fun. I'd like for us to have a little giggle. And before I go, another word or step further, you've heard me reference Jan and Jerry out in Vegas. They write in frequently, listening to the show together. Well, they'll be taking a break for a while. I got a note from Jan. She said, I figure I should let you know that Jerry had a bout in the hospital in January. And she says, not to ask for pity, but more to advise you. Well, it's not about pity. It's about the common sense of shared emotional life, I think, that we have created here. So hopefully Jerry is on the mend, and Jan and Jerry both will be okay, we hope. But the doctor has said, no stress for you, Jerry! So that means no listening to the horn for a little while, because the fact of the matter is, if you're actually tuned in and turned on and you're paying attention to what's happening in the world, this can be a little tough. And I acknowledge it for y'all, or you can acknowledge it for yourself, but I acknowledge it for myself. Sometimes it's difficult just to go through the news every blessed day, and you get to where you did. Oh, holy cow. So I more than understand needing to take a break. And, you know, Jan, Jerry, if you should happen to be listening this evening, we think about you. You're in our hearts, and you will continue to be. And when you feel up to it, you want to get back into the mix and into the fray, you know what? We'll be waiting. We'll keep the light on for you. We'll be right here. And just our sincere hopes, Jerry, for getting well. Now, with that in mind, I offer all that because I would like to engage in a little bit of giggling, because I had, and you know, I guess it's because they're so few and far between and so daggum rare that you remember them so with so much clarity. When Albert just slayed me Wednesday night with that, it's the eye, you know, the eye of Mordor, referencing the bleary, watery eye of that old Nazi anti-aircraft gunner in Rome. I came apart. There was something special about that that just made me laugh my butt off. And we all need those. And we need those badly. And consequently, there are a couple of good giggles out there that I really do think we should avail ourselves of. First of all, you remember the legislator in Oklahoma, Stan? She actually had to explain to people that she was mocking. And this kind of goes to show you how right-wingers think. Even though her amendment to the bill, the fetal personhood bill in Oklahoma, even though that bill and her amendment to it, especially the amendment, was offered as a spoof, you know, the one that would have made masturbation or depositing one's semen anywhere but in the vagina of a female. Anybody in their right mind looks at that and goes, well, that's an attempt to make a mockery of the fetal personhood bill and ultrasound and all that other silly crap that people who are obsessed with destroying the privacy rights of the female half of our species are constantly on about, right? That's easy. I guess there were some right-wingers in Oklahoma, Stan, who said, praise Jesus, you know, it's not a bad idea. Maybe that's what we should do. Because after all, you know, it grows hair on your palms and makes you... Right, yeah. And she actually had to explain it. No, she was doing that as a protest act against the hatefulness of the... So, everybody, take a deep breath. And a giggle. Because it's funny. And I guess that's one of the problems that some the Democratic legislators are having. Toward the end of the program last night, a story broke. And this is because those on our side are so accustomed to hearing this kind of insanity come from the right wing. You know, whether it's the fact that one may no longer teach Shakespeare's The Tempest in Tucson, Arizona, or whether it was, a few years ago when an upstanding God-fearing follower of Jeebus in Alabama proposed a bill that would remove all books from all publicly funded libraries that were either authored by a homosexuality or had any men had any homosexual references in them. That creep's name was Gerald Allen, I do believe. Well, how did that stay on a brain cell? So many other things just slip right off. It would have effectively shut down every library in Alabama, which probably would have been fine with those upstanding thumpers. But we're used to that kind of stuff. We no longer are surprised by it. We expect it now, right? And so toward the end of the program last night, when I saw the headline, Mississippi Representative Wants Gulf of Mexico Changed to Gulf of America, this is the part where the giggling starts. Oh, God. It was Mississippi State Legislature Member Representative Steve Holland. And he actually introduced a bill in the House of Representatives of the state of Mississippi, Stan, calling upon the state of Mississippi to rename the portion of the Gulf of Mexico that borders his state, you know, that little boot heel of Mississippi that sits exactly opposite the boot heel of Alabama, calling for that to be referred to as the Gulf of America. Now, he can't rename the whole thing because he's just a little old piddling state legislator, but the part that touches Mississippi we want to refer to as the Gulf of America. Now, I read this, and a little light went off for me when I read that he was a Democrat. It's kind of like the little light that went off for me when I read the story a week or so ago of the legislator in the Old Dominion, Virginia, who wanted to make sure that before men could get a Viagra prescription, they had to get a rectal exam and be given a cardiac stress test to make sure that they understood the consequences of taking that little blue pill. These are beautiful little moments. And when I saw D after Steve Holland's name, I went, wait a minute. But apparently, and I say this as a sort of little mental health intervention for our side, because they've got us absolutely primed, the right wing does. We are so ready to be outraged at what they... that we just bang and we're gone. Oh, wait, that was somebody clapping their hands, not shooting the starting gun. And we sheepishly walk back to the starting blocks. You guys want to race now? Okay. And who knew these existed? After Steve Holland introduced his bill calling for the portion of the Gulf of Mexico bordering Mississippi to be renamed the Gulf of America, a Latino GOP organization. You know, that's like log cabin Republicans. That's like, you know, the African American, you know, J.D. Watts and two or three other guys, GOP Republic, Latin, yeah, a Latino GOP organization. Yeah, they jumped. This is a hair trigger nation on this Friday on the front porch. It's a hair trigger nation because a local Latin GOP organization, called Café con Leche said, if this bill passes the legislature and is signed into law, perhaps it is time to rename the Mississippi River. After all, sharing a name with a state that wants to rewrite maps out of disdain for Mexicans would be a disgrace to the rest of the nation. Forgive me, but Bob Quasius, Café con Leche's president, to Bob Quasius I say, buddy, you might want to rethink that whole Latino GOP organization thing before you start to, because, you know, you're right next door to Alabama where they've got it, they're doing everything but rounding up brown people and putting them in internment camps. I think the term that Willard Romney uses for it is what? Yes, self-deportation programs. That's yeah. If this bill passes the legislature and is signed into law, perhaps it's time to rename the Mississippi River. After all, sharing a name with a state that wants to rewrite maps out of disdain for Mexicans would be a disgrace to the rest of the nation. There's only one problem. Representative Steve Holland, Democrat from Mississippi, did it as an attempt to shed light on the hatefulness of the GOP. Holland went on Mississippi Public Broadcasting, and he told a broadcaster there by the name of Daniel Cherry, he said, so many of my Republican colleagues seem to want to push anything or anyone Mexican out of the state of Mississippi. He said, I'm just trying to embrace their cause and help them out. Now, right as I was about to fall for this, I was thinking, maybe we could put a rush a bill through the Congress changing the name of Mississippi to Moronistan. But again, it's kind of like the onion. Sometimes the satire just gets a little too close to truth, and it's hard to tell the difference because would any of us have blinked if we had found out that a Republican had actually done this? I mean, we lived through freedom fries and freedom toast, right? We live in an America that celebrated and loved a song by Toby Keith that talked about going to put a boot in somebody's ass. Lady Liberty wears, who knew Liberty? Yeah, she wears cowboy boots under them green robes. I don't know. I expect the next follow-up to say that the Café con Leche, the GOP Latino organization, is a joke, too. The Gulf of America. But that is a more than effective example of exactly how twisted this culture is at this point. And it's only February. After Labor Day, I would say, it's like reverse Groundhog Day after Labor Day in this country. Just go into a hole and stay there. Come out, go vote, don't vote, whatever you're going to do. But, you know, we'll all just hide and tell ghost stories or something because it can't be anybody else. It can't be any scarier than anything that's going to be out there. Remember, I'm still looking for somebody to go place a bet for me at a betting parlor somewhere in the UK that within the next 4 weeks, Rick Frothy Mixture Santorum will claim that Barack Obama has said that he wants the last Republican to be strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Just saying, it's, you know, it's out there. I miss one once in a while. We never did get around to getting Michelle Bachmann to Ottumwa, Iowa, to praise the heroic efforts of Korean War veteran Walter O'Reilly. But I still think it could have happened. Andy says, Andy says I'm sounding like an Obama apologist. No, I'm not. I've got a lot of problems with Barack Obama, but my God, I understand. I at least understand the nature. Anybody who's ever been in a leadership position understands. Andy says, Mr. Obama's not a leader. Please, Bob, enough with the apologies. It's not an apology. Can the man do nothing right? Because that No Child Left Behind left thing looks like it's at least an administrative effort to correct a problem. Andy says he will not fight, does not want to fight, and doesn't have the ability to fight because there's no fight in the Chicago school neoliberal dog. Jesus, I don't think we talked this badly about George W. Bush. It could be he's doing what he wants to do. Playing to the right might be where he's truly at on the political spectrum. The Republicans know this. They know he will give in to the pressure, just collapse under pressure, especially when it comes at him fast and furious from the corporate-run media echo chamber. He could use the bully pulpit and stand up for the working-class citizen, but he doesn't and won't. His actions should leave everyone with no question. He represents the top 1%, period. The top 1% are his constituency and Wall Street, not the 99%. You know, you may be right. But I'll tell you what. If the Affordable Care Act can survive the Supreme Court challenge, and I will be broadcasting live from Capitol Hill at that point in time, March the 26th and 27th, I believe it is, 2012, courtesy of the fine folks at Families USA, the usual, probably Tom Hartman will be there, all kinds of folks. Hope Sam Cedar's there. I'd just like to sit down and have a cup of decaf with Sam. Sam's probably a caffeine guy. But anyway, if the Affordable Care Act goes through and suddenly parents who have a couple of kids and make $50,000 a year can avail themselves of Medicaid, will we at least acknowledge that that feels an awful lot like a public option, that that feels a very great deal like a sort of universal single-payer health care, that it's an expansion? Because the right wing won't talk about it. We talked about that last night. I am by no means an Obama apologist. I have not hesitated to be critical on a number of accounts. But Jesus, are we so bad off that now we won't give any credit? Or are we just so jaded that we expect it to be some sort of Trojan horse for something more obnoxious? I don't know. Jeanette emailing, she says people talked worse about Bush. No, I mean I remember referring to him as a dim leader. And God knows I remember Malloy talking, referring to him as Raisin Brain, because that always made me giggle. I don't recall anybody ever referring to George W. Bush as a dog. But Jeanette says people talked worse about Bush, and I personally think Obama's worse on several issues as bad on others. And that's the thing about believing. Oh, thank you. And by the way, a thank you going out. Thank you very much for a very kind and generous contribution. Jim sending along the story, and of course it comes. You want to hear how the right wing talks about him? Obama reverses birth control mandate. This is not reflective of Jim's thinking on the issue. He is forwarding along something that was sent to him. In a belated attempt at damage control, President Barack Obama reversed course on the controversial HHS mandate requiring faith-based institutions to provide their employees with health policies covering birth control, the morning after pill, and sterilizations. But whether he can staunch the political bloodletting over the issue remains to be seen. God, they can't stay away from that stuff. They love that eliminationist, bloody, yuck. Obama shifted the mandated responsibility for paying for reproductive procedures, which the Catholic Church has long found morally objectionable, from religious institutions onto the health insurance companies. But editor's notes. Special prostate size can greatly affect quality of life and sleep. What size is yours? See this photo. Arthritis pain can be stopped using natural nutrients, but it remains an open question whether the compromise will be acceptable to either the Catholic Church or the insurance industry, even as the controversy has reinvigorated the social conservative movement. Under the scheme, religious organizations will not be responsible for providing birth control. However, women employed by organizations such as Catholic hospitals, schools, or universities will still be able to get contraceptives from their insurance companies. Jesus. And, you know, there's another example of it. This is not the full-on surrender that I figured... The Obama administration would be capable of in this. It's rather rational under the circumstances. Now, I, for one, would prefer that he, you know, stood his ground, drew a line in the sand, and put up his fists all like Teddy Roosevelt and everything, and said, "Walk softly, but carry a big stick." I'd prefer that. But it seems like the Republicans are the only ones who do that. And it may be telling on them, because a rather shocking study that came out in the last 24 hours or so indicates that 1 in 5 conservatives, 1 in 5 Republicans, have taken a look at the frothy mixture, at cranky old Ron Paul, at Dr. Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist, and Willard Romney and his magic underwear. And said, you know, no, I think I'm just going to vote for the guy who's already there. A special announcement coming in from our buddy Spike. You may remember the conversation a few nights ago. He says, just wanted to let you know and the Horn family know, I was officially appointed the full-time Pennsylvania deputy constable for Coolbaugh Township, PA. Who wouldn't want to live in Coolbaugh? It really is Coolbaugh. Coolbaugh Township, PA. Once I have my official swearing in and state training, I will be on the streets working around Halloween. Yes, Virginia, there is a progressive in law enforcement, and yes, retired Philly Captain Ray Lewis is a personal hero. Congratulations, Spike! Way to go! He's been kind of relentless in this, and tireless, and what does that old aphorism say? Nothing can take the place of persistence, and it's the truth. Andy noting Obama just gave us 2 new nuclear reactors, the first in 30 years. I suppose Fukushima never happened. Then he caved on birth control insurance through religious employers, something that's been law since 1964. Come on, Bob, wake up. Well, Andy, you're assuming facts that are not in evidence. You're assuming that I am asleep. I'm not. What I am, though, is a realistic member, a realistic citizen of an empire. It could be argued that some people are actually asleep because they think this is still some sort of republic. It isn't. that somehow democratic principles still hold sway in this country. They don't. Those things, in a way, I'm far more cynical than some, because I recognize that there are that once you've become an empire, you do not willingly go back, and we are. And you know, I've used the various and sundry Caesar's arguments before. Wow, what happened to the giggling on Front Porch Friday? Damn. What you will have every 4 to 8 years, depending on the circumstances, is a choice between generally a Claudius or a Marcus Aurelius or a Vespasian, you know, the so-called good emperors, or you can have a Caligula, a Nero, Galba, Otho. There are many more bad ones than good ones, frankly. The Commodus. And it's the only choice you get. That's all. Sorry. We're talking about imperial administrators. We don't have a monarchy, so we don't get to have ourselves a czar or a kaiser or a queen of England. We get an imperial administrator. Some will be more humane than others. Some will be less fascist than others. But, you know, when Octavian became... when Octavian consolidated power in the Roman Empire, in Rome, after the Battle of Actium, and after Mark Antony did his bit with the sword, and Cleopatra did her thing with it, you know, she made an ass of herself. Power consolidated in the hands of one man. Although there was still a Senate in Rome, and great care was made to pretend at the legislative duties of both the Senate and the plebs. And that persisted for hundreds of years. There, when the empire's capital left Rome, and all that had been the Roman Empire became centered at Byzantium, lo and behold, they still considered themselves the Roman Empire. And they still had a Senate. But the whole damn thing functioned on the success or failure of the emperor. And quadrennial electoral politics notwithstanding, that's where we are. It just is. And it does me no good to talk about that. It doesn't make me feel good to know that my children are growing up in empire. There was a time when people were less enlightened, when, for instance, the UK was proud of its empire, that empire was something to be proud of, but we recognize now that they aren't. Empires are the mangers, the cradles, the creches of agony and misery and exploitation, especially in far-flung places away from the imperial capital. Democracies, I cannot think of a single example in the entire history of human endeavor where a democracy has ever survived. They always devolve. And, you know, ours made it for 100 years. Not quite about 80 years. It began falling apart, well, 10. It started falling apart with Jefferson when he made the Louisiana Purchase, I'm sorry. Then the forced cession of lands by First Peoples, as done, and the genocide engaged in by Andrew Jackson. And then the Civil War. followed by the rise of the administrative state. Always remember, for all that we revere him, why was Abraham Lincoln able to run for president? Because he had made himself a tidy little nest egg being a railroad company lawyer. That's the kind of lawyer Abraham Lincoln was. He represented railroads, running people off their land, cheating people out of their own ground, making sure that that America was safe for the corporate railroad barons. Democracy in this country is a fantasy. It's a sugar tit. It doesn't exist. I mean, yeah, okay, sure, you live in Vermont, and I envy you, and you get to go to a meeting once a week where you decide which pothole you'll pave that week. That's democracy, and I think it'd be pretty cool to participate in it. Can you imagine that happening in Alabama, Stan? Because I can't. Now, how long is it going to take to pass a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United? How many years? How much damage can be done by then? Oh, wait, you might like to have a constitutional convention so that we can get rid of this presidency thing and have a parliamentary form of government where, you know, everybody gets a share based upon how many votes they poll. Because right now we've got a winner-take-all system, and none of the above isn't on the ballot, and neither is anything else except the two or three names that'll be there, and the choice will be between one of two people. Now, call me whatever you wish for that, but it is the call me lastly a realist, because I live in reality land. And either Barack Obama or Willard Romney, Frothy Santorum, Cranky Old Ron Paul, or Dr. Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist, whichever one of those four the GOP picks, or maybe it'll still be Jeb Bush and I'll win my bet. One of those people. It's going to be Barack Obama or one of those people. I'm sorry. You know, it'd be nice. It'd be nice to have it be somebody else, but we don't have a system that admits of third-party politics. The Whigs had to die before the Republicans could rise up and put Abraham Lincoln in the Oval Office. Right? I mean, sure, there's vanity voting. You can do that. But one of those two people will be president. You know, at one point in time, the biggest single vote getter for a third-party candidacy had been Eugene V. Debs of the Socialist Party. He ran for president while he was in prison. He got a lot of votes. He didn't even come close. Teddy Roosevelt decided to run on the Bull Moose Party. Yeah. He didn't even come close. Patty, writing in. How about President Newtmare? Sanatorium. Ray Miney. I may not be pleased with Obama, but really? Let's all get freaking real. Do we remember Clinton? NAFTA, CAFTA, GATT, WTO, Glass-Steagall? Sure, it's easy to argue that the Democrats are as bad as the Republicans. No, it's easy to make that claim. It's a little harder to prove. Because every once in a while, the Democrats will throw us a sop. The Republicans never throw any sops. Corey in Louisville, under the heading, It's What We Have Now. To all of those complaining about Barack Obama as not being a real Democrat in office, I only have this one thing to ask. What have you done about it to change this? Have you pressured your local and state Democratic parties to promote candidates who have more real Democratic ideals and values? I know in Andy's case, he has. Have you thought of it? Andy's working now. Andy walks the walk and talks the talk. That's why we dialogue like this. Have you thought about running for office yourself locally to get your feet in the door? I can't do it for myself. I can't do it myself, for I am not a Democrat, nor do I ever plan on registering as a Democrat, because neither party has nor deserves my support if it won't stand up for the people. But it's always bothered me and angered me when the rank-and-file Democratic Party members start complaining about the party leaders but don't ever attempt to do something about it. Sorry about the rant, but I had to get that off my chest. But for a giggle, did you hear that Andrew Breitbart declared that the Crooks and Liars blog is a radical left-wing website? Jesus, you're kidding. Oh, no, he's not. There's the link. Radical leftist website. Well, on that recommendation, this might actually be kind of funny.
Your movie, The Undefeated, got panned by both critics and audiences. What do you think will make this movie different?
First of all, who's Andrew Metcalf? I want to just state this is always a fun gesture. Is that your name?
Yes, that's my name.
Okay.
Well, I just checked IMDb. It got a rating of 1.7 on RottenTomatoes.com. You received a 0% rating, so I'm just wondering.
Crooks and Liars, that's it. It's a radical leftist website, and he's just here to, but he can answer for himself. But I guess the way that you presented yourself, you represent Occupy very well.
That's right.
Oh, I'm actually asking a legitimate question. About one of your previous movies being panned by both critics and audiences. What's going to make this one any different?
By the way, the film was not panned by audiences. We had tremendous audience reaction, tremendous viewership on pay-per-view. We shipped 250.
Do you see how the right wing operates? Now, this is simply a question about the miserable failure of a film called The Undefeated, which for a woman who was defeated in her bid for the vice presidency is rather an ironic title, to say the least. But instead of answering the question, Andrew Breitbart, you're from that radical leftist website. You know what? I don't know. Has he been drinking Bill O'Reilly protein shakes or something? That's the tip. Hey. Sandra writing in. The epitome of empire. The real reason for the Department of Homeland Security, globalization, securing the world for the elites and their interests. Yeah, and this is the conduct of empire. The urgent need to protect the global supply chain. An opinion piece from Reuters by Janet Napolitano. Every day, staggering numbers of air, land, and sea passengers, as well as millions of tons of cargo, move between nations. International trade and commerce has long driven the development of nations and provided unprecedented economic growth. Indeed, our future prosperity depends upon it. 10 years after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, we also continue to see the determination of individuals and groups to disrupt economies by targeting our transit and cargo systems. Well, remember, one of the things that they like to say about globalization is TINA. There is no alternative. And I remember to this day the stunning lecture that I heard down in Berea, Kentucky a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, about Lois. TINA has some competition. There is no alternative to the global economy. But it turns out there is. And she's Lois. Locally owned, independently sourced. But the global economy has never been a people movement. It's an elite movement. It's a movement whereby the 1% rip and rape a little bit more each day out of a rapidly shrinking pool of exploitable resources. Does that sound about right? Yeah. And everybody, Republican or Democrat, has to deal with that reality. You know, we can crank up the international and put on our little bandera rosa, but it is what it is. Global communism never quite caught on, but by God, global capitalism did. And the ultimate impact is the same: less freedom, not more, and ultimately authoritarian structures. So, there. Yeah. Let's test the phone system. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello. Oh, golly, I hope we're not going to have problems with the phone system. Well, that may have been you hanging up, or it may have been a problem with our own system here. We shall find out in short order. That is not inspiring. Back to the email for just a minute. Jim writing in, what exactly... We had this question last night, or night before. What exactly is the magic underwear? No kidding. Jim. I think I went over this at some length. Maybe you weren't listening, Jim. But the magic underwear is our temple vestments, temple garments that are required to be worn immediately next to the skin once you become a 33rd degree noble exalted Mormon, or whatever they call them, under prophet or whatever. Men and women, you got to wear the magic, and they're the ones who call it the magic underwear. That's not something I came up with. Mormons refer to their magic underwear. They have a mythology that's built around it, whereby magic underwear has been said to stop bullets. Not that it does. That's like saying the Virgin Mary appears on, you know, the Kaiser roll. But that's the magic underwear, and you have to wear it. You can't get around you. If you're faithful, don't be caught dead without your mat. Don't be caught dead in no little, you know, Michael Jordan Haynes brief or nothing. No, sir. Not if you're a 33rd exalted Mormon who's going to have his own planet when he dies, and it's going to be people, and he's going to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of wives, and just hop from bed to bed to bed to bed to bed. And really, because that's what the theology teaches. You're going to be a god on your own planet. I'm not kidding. But you know what? You can't have it if you die without your magic underwear on. So, there we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's Friday on the front porch.
And hallelujah, the phones work. Okay, thank you. Hey, David.
Yeah, hey. One quick thing. I think people need to... What's that email they have to contact?
Oh, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com.
And that would be for, I think, fundraising.
And yes, it does apply. If you want to make sure that no transfer costs are attached to your PayPal contribution, you go to PayPal, you use that address to send money, bobkincaid@gmail.com, and then pick personal and gift, and boom. No,
so spontaneous. So one more time, they go to bobkincaid@gmail.com.
That's right, David. They do. They go to bobkincaid@gmail.com.
Okay, that's good. I just gotta have to make that clear for a lot of people who.
And the snail mail address is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab contribute.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So everyone pretty much has that clear. And if you don't, you just tuned in. It's bobkincaid@gmail.com. And if you just tuned in just now, you need to listen to the podcast, because we're not going to do this all night.
No, I mean, this has its limits, David.
Yeah, I know. I mean...
It ain't Labor Day, and this ain't no telethon, and I ain't going to cry.
Right. Before I get into a little bit of the politics thing, I do want to pay my respects to one of the great music producers of our time. His passing is celebrated because he died in 2006 of lupus. Magnificent, amazing J.D. coming out of Detroit, J. Dilla, from the crew Slum Village. He was also in a Tribe Called Quest's production crew. An amazing producer, an amazing musician, considered the god of the NPC. And I learned an interesting fact that really does show you the spirit of this man was on his last album called Donuts. This is going to freak everyone out listening to this. He actually literally could not speak and could not talk, and he left messages in his samples of his music. So the samples that he chose, and he was making this at his bedside, people, with his little sampler in his last days on earth, in his last moments, and he left messages for all his family and friends, even his mother, all the samples. So whatever he wanted to say, he said it through the sampler.
Wow.
So rest in peace, J. Dilla. Also inspired people like D'Angelo, Questlove, Q-Tip. Busta Rhymes has made a pledge to his family that he's going to include a track on every single album that he releases. So there, that's some kind of loyalty for you to a great innovator and a master of samples. What he could do was just amazing. He actually literally, without the help of Pro Tools and anything like that, he could memorize where samples were on records and make the sample beats on the fly with just a little and that comes from his ability to make pause mixtapes using the pause button's production. And it really, if you really want to check out the world of J. Dilla, they just put a great documentary on BBC One Extra, and I urge everyone to check it because it's really inspiring. If you come from a similar background that J.D. comes from, or even if you don't, just to catch out and see how much he inspired to the world of hip-hop and of music in general. So many people were inspired by this guy, even though he didn't have the notoriety in the music industry as a celebrity producer or anything like that. But he was quite amazing, and they're also celebrating his legacy in Detroit right now. So that's just something to remember. J. Dilla, J.D., James Yancey. Remember him. If you haven't checked out his music,
worth a listen.
Worth a listen, and definitely.
Well, speaking of music related items,
yeah.
My head writer David in Tennessee, one of your brothers in the fraternity of Davidness, has the night off. He and his son are heading down into Nash, Vegas, because the patron saint band of the Horn is playing tonight.
Oh my God, that's great!
Yeah, wouldn't you love to see the drive-by truckers in Nashville? Yeah,
that would be great to see that. I did want to mention something regarding what Andy was saying about the. I noticed this more and more about how, and I really think that if someone made this and someone created this, it would really put a lot of people would start to see a lot of things more clear and focused. I've thought about this. If someone were to make a political game based on your political reality, your dream president, you're just a complete simulation, and you were to experience what anyone is to experience going in that White House or what have you, you would have so many similar incidents that you have with any president that you choose. We can't keep talking about this fantasy, people. There is no fantasy president. There is no fantasy decision. Everything is going to have consequences. I don't like... Here's some real brutal truth for you. I don't like a lot of stuff that Obama does, but here's the point that I'd like to hit home. But I understand that with every choice that he makes, he's going to have blowback. He's going to have drawbacks. We don't.
And you cannot be president of the United States, David, without doing business with the 1%.
Right.
And the idea that there's something new in that is a bit naive. Because the people, you know, the first president of the United States was George Washington. Like, I need to tell anybody that. Well, he was a one percenter. So was John Adams. So was Thomas Jefferson. Now, Jefferson remained persistently and perpetually in debt, but he was still a one percenter. If you follow the Prism West Virginia American History series, you'll find that this nation, for the most part, has always run for the benefit of the 1%. It is the fact that we have finally become aware of it and wise to it that's created the popular movement. But you know, to bring it to light. But pending the change that will be required, which probably is a wholesale rewrite of the Constitution. You're going to have two-party politics, and it's just going to be that. And eventually, if one party fades away, the third party will rise up to replace it. Or it will transition itself. What you're seeing, for instance, right now, may be argued that it is the fade-out of what is left of progressivism and liberalism in this country. You know, as a progressive and a liberal, I grieve at that. I hope it's not true. You know, you see things like Wisconsin and the pushback in Ohio, and you think, you know, we've still got a chance. But there's no guarantee. So...
Yeah, I understand you. I understand completely. And I would say that the only thing I can say to people who are saying, but what about this, what about this, what about this? You know, the only thing I can say to you is painstaking incrementalism. So many people around the world, listen to me now, so many people around the world, people, would die for the place we're in right now. Would die for that moment. Even as flawed as all of our politicians and leaders are, I can trade you a horror beyond horrors that you would never want to go. So that's the choices we have, what we have right now. Do I like it? No. But I'm one person, and you're one person, and everything that you think that is in your mind is could be a reality, that's fantasy. Do you understand that? That's fantasy. You have to deal with the concrete collective reality that we are dealing with all right now. You cannot deal with the reality in your head. You can do that in an artist rendering of a portrait, music, books, whatever you're into, sports, you can have that dream moment for yourself. But for us as a nation, it's not going to happen. We have to deal with what's here.
It is, and that's kind of reality, right?
Right. It's reality. And Bob, you know, the thing about it is, though, is that I would like to hear somebody, and if anyone's getting angry or getting emotional or anything, give me your dream cabinet, give me your dream presidency, give me everything that you want on that platter, and guess what will happen? Everything that you wished for is going to be dismantled, just like it is with Barack Obama, just the way it is with any politician, because you have to deal with the reality that's left together. Whatever happens, the choices that you make, you're going to have those consequences, and that's what you have to deal with then. And that's a hard thing to admit for a lot of people. I hear a lot of progressives stumble over this. They say, no, if we just had this president, no, if we just had this senator, no, if we just had this congressman, no.
Well, no, look, I mean, okay, backing up just a hair.
Yeah.
The real fight, the biggest fight, is the Senate this year. I'm
right.
Again, coming from that position of realism, the House is not going to change hands.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate may and become full-on fascist Republican. Okay? Jim Webb in Virginia was a right-wing enough Democrat, and look who's running for that seat. You've got Tim Kaine, a Democrat who was such a profound chairman of the Democratic National Committee that he actually contributed to the ass beating that we took that the Democratic Party took in 2010. Yeah, I'm still a registered Democrat.
Right.
Or you can have George Macaca Allen. Fun.
Yeah, that's some choice right there. I mean, I don't, and the other thing I don't like is when people say there's no choice between the two. No, there's a definite choice.
Oh, there will be. Depending on who it is, there will be shades of difference. Look at Wisconsin. I was just talking to our good buddy Bruce up there the other day, and he was talking about the candidate they have running for governor there. He referred to her as a sort of a Midwestern Elizabeth Warren type. And she'll be running against Snot Walker. Now, am I going to get the same Democrats are as bad as Republicans argument there? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
but the thing is, if you want that progressive, that really progressive president, you know, the one who draws lines in sand and tells Republicans to knock chips off his shoulder and stuff, you got to get him into the office. Now,
right.
I for one didn't think that Barack Obama was never a progressive. He was what we projected upon him.
Mm-hmm.
Even the health care plan that he was talking about when he was running for office was less liberal than so-called Hillary care. Yeah, I remember little inconvenient things like that. Rahm Emanuel, whose father said to some friend of theirs who was complaining about Barack Obama not being friendly enough to Israel, Rahm Emanuel's father said, "Listen, it's not like he's some Arab washing the floors," talking about his son Rahm.
Right.
You know, it's disgusting. Geithner, no thank you. Larry Summers, there's plenty to. One of his National Security Council guys is a guy who was actively involved in blowing up mountains because he sat on, Jesus, what board was it? Was it the Massey board, maybe? I don't remember. Sure, there's lots to gripe about here. But beyond the griping, what do you do? And the what do you do part is, there has to be public financing of political campaigns. There has to be a wholesale revamp of voting in this country that gets rid of all the electronic video game voting, whether it be touchscreen or optical scan. We have to go back to pens and papers and X's in boxes that are counted by people one at a time. You have to get rid of Citizens United.
Mm.
And if you want that parliamentary proportional representation thing, you've got to have a constitutional convention. And that's the one that really gives me the turtle squirts, David. Because, wow, I don't know, where would you hold it? Philly? New York? Madison Square Garden, maybe?
Jeb Bush's backyard.
And the corporate sponsorships and the power that the right wing has relative to progressives and liberals. Can you imagine the money that would pour into that? You don't want what would come out of a constitutional convention in the 21st century in the United States of America. There's a constitution kerfuffle going on right now, as a matter of fact, David. I don't know if you've heard about this or not, but it's a dandy. Right wingers are having a show enough plum hissy over what? Well, some remarks by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Justice Ginsburg gave a speech to a small group of Egyptian people. You know, last night we had the clip of Justice Sotomayor appearing on Sesame Street. Well, Justice Ginsburg spoke to a group of Egyptians. And she told that Egyptian audience that she would recommend against using the United States Constitution as the model for a new Egyptian constitution.
Hmm.
Now, the right wing has gone into full-on, no kidding, absolute hissy mode, okay? They're calling for her to be impeached and resigned and maybe drawed and quartered. Okay? Why? Because she didn't say that the U.S. Constitution was handed down from the hand of God to James Madison from Sinai. Liberty Counsel said, Justice Ginsburg has insulted the Constitution. At the Daily Caller, it was, she's dissing the Constitution while abroad. I didn't know it was nice to call women broads anymore. Oh, they mean overseas. Well, listen, yeah, that's how I expect the same thing of the right wing. Let's see. Breitbart, she has disdain for the Constitution. Red State, she has a perverted judicial philosophy. Let's see. American Spectator, Justice Ginsburg should resign. All because she said, and this is the essence of it, she said, look, the Constitution was put together in 1787. Maybe that's 200 years of human experience that you might want to consider in framing it up. Now, that's not crazy, is it?
Nope.
But the right wing's having a hissy. Because that shows she's un-American. Please. But oddly enough, as Think Progress points out, Antonin Scalia recently said, the Bill of Rights of the former evil empire, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was much better than ours. But no outrage. Sorry.
You see, the whole thing with this is another constant reminder of the fact why so many people are going to choose corporate DLC over right-wing evangelical crazies. I know that's going to make a lot of people angry, but that's the choice. The Democrats that we have in office right now, it's going to take forever and a day for them to change into what we'd like to, what we'd like for them to be representative of us.
And that's not to say, you know, that's not to say that people should give up and go home, David. That's not my point. My point is that any fight that you get into, you've got to get into it, A, with a goal, and B, with it's like a roadmap. You know, if I'm sitting here in West Virginia and I want to drive to see you in Maine, it's not going to do me any good to start mapping my journey from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. You got to know where you are and where you want to get to. Well, we know where we'd like to get to, but as long as we don't acknowledge where we are, i.e. empire, we're going to have a hard time getting started. And, you know, the stuff that was being talked about on the program last night, drones flying over? Really? Surveillance cams with face recognition technology in New York City? I mean, New Yorkers must not know about it because it would be, all those surveillance cams would just be people holding up their middle finger, yeah, this, you know, take a picture of this. Right? Because it's New York.
Mm-hmm.
Or New Yorkers just, you know, can't be bothered and, you know, it's beneath their contempt. New Yorkers are cool either way you slice it. Yeah, photograph this. That's America. This is an America where there's a guy sitting in Congress who, as we discussed the other night, one of his formative images of his childhood was watching some sleaze merchant literally flout the rationing rules of the Second World War that were designed to keep our troops from starving in the field. And now that's held up as how did he describe it? The free market solving government mischief. I can't get that one out of my head, David. That's libertarianism.
I mean,
this means something to me because I'm connected to my history and my family. If every butcher in America had done what that sleazy butcher in Pittsburgh did, all the meat you want for a price on Saturdays, if every butcher in America had done that, What would my father have eaten in the belly of that aircraft carrier? What would my two uncles who didn't come home, what would they have eaten before they were killed?
Not prime rib, that's for sure.
Well, not sea rations either.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, open up the damn little can and see a note from cranky ass Ron Paul saying, "The free market has solved government mischief." You know, F you, Ron Paul. It astonishes. I mean, that the Second World War, and we could have the political discussion on it if necessary, but the Second World War was the last time that the United States actually acted as close as is humanly possible for a nation of this size as one. And understood the concept of a shared sacrifice and a shared goal, shared desires, and shared success. After we won the war, it was game on. You know, the full-on capitalism ramped right back up. But that story just astonishes me. I can't believe that. I don't know, maybe not many people read that story. But we went from 1940s Ron Paul ism, and that stuff, you know, there's a reality to it. That stuff got traction because if you remember during George Bush's war on the people of Iraq, Halliburton was being paid $29 per soldier per day to feed our personnel there, and were busted serving rotten meat. So yeah, there are little lines that get drawn between things like Ron Paul thinking it's okay to screw American servicemen for that butcher to do that, and lo and behold, soldiers in 2003, 2004 being served rotten meat in Iraq. Right?
I mean, right. And you know, this just goes to show yet another reason why we have to have a lot of these Democratic moderates in a lot of different districts that we don't want them. Because the problem is we don't have the chance, the probability that we're going to replace them all with progressives in the next, say, 2 years.
Well, and that's, you know, look, the House is going to be Republican. I mean, I'm not trying to pee on anybody's Wheaties or anything. But is there any scenario whereby anybody thinks that, you know, short of a bunch of right wingers being raptured or called home to Jesus or whatever, that Democrats have a chance? Because there's not a Democrat that has a chance anywhere in the so-called Solid South.
Mm.
Because they want their conservative family values, and they haven't been hurt enough to recognize the nature of those who are doing the harm. So the South's out. We're not going to get any seats there. We're going to be down one seat in Ohio that's either going to be Marcy Kaptur or Dennis Kucinich. And I hope it's Ms. Kaptur. I mean, she's done some good, but I really don't want a Congress that doesn't even have the one lone voice crying in the wilderness that is Dennis Kucinich. You know, where are, I mean, they're adding congressional seats in the South. They're adding congressional seats in Texas. Guess what kind of seats those are going to be? Hint, not progressives.
Definitely not progressive. And, you know, this was just another reminder. I was reading there's a great article on that Ari Berman did on redistricting in the South, pretty well in depth and in detail. And basically what it points to, people, is the fact that, yeah, you better hold on to a lot of these DLC memberships across America, because that's what you're going to have to get used to for however much time it takes for to have a solid progressive base of seats that we can replace these DLCers with. But until then, you know what? What can I say? You better start learning how to play golf with them or something.
And I can't imagine that.
Yeah, I know. You can't.
Because, you know, I haven't played in years, but I used to love to play golf. And
yeah.
But the thing is, whenever you play with a right winger, you know what you find out? Those little bastards cheat. They kick their ball. They winter rules. Improve your lie, Judge Schmales. I'll take a free drop here. Oh, is that my third mulligan? Yeah, the little bastards cheat.
I mean, that's what... Bob, that's the problem. That's what we're left with. And who say, well, so you're going to choose the lesser of two evils? I don't think like that. Here's how I think like that. We have generations and generations of children that are about to be born that are depending on us to make the right decision. And if that requires us to suffer a bit to get this painstaking incrementalism, what I told you about, then so be it. That's the choice we have to make as a nation.
Yeah, I know. I'll get an email over the weekend. Andy said, he said, I do value your opinions. I started quite a controversy. No, it's not a controversy.
It's a discussion.
I would love to live in a country with proportional representation.
Right.
Because then I could go and join up with some party that shared my values. Because, you know, let's get something straight. The Democratic Party in West Virginia does not share my values. The Democratic Party in West Virginia shares the values of the coal industry. God almighty, I'm the last guy that needs to be told about being sold out. You know, you can't talk to Democrat or Republican about ending mountaintop removal in this state. Well, what are we going to do about the jobs?
You know, Bob, when it really all comes down to this, and this is what a lot of liberals and progressives don't want to admit, but it's true. Eventually, you and me and everyone collectively are going to have to work with these evil bastards, or these light bastards, or these moderate bastards, or these diet bastards. But we're going to have to work. Otherwise, we're going to sink. What's your choice, America?
I hate the watery sort of pathetic legislation that comes out of working with those evil fuckers. Oh, sorry. We have examples of that. Let's go back in history for a little bit. In the 1970s, there was a full-on move to outright outlaw strip mining. This is before mountaintop removal ever got much of a hold. It was during the Carter administration, and that movement had huge, huge followings and considerable success. But instead of crafting a bill that said, thou shalt not no more, as Ken Heckler wanted back then, and what a man he is, up in his 90s and still fighting, instead of doing that, we got the Surface Mine Control and Surface Mine Reclamation and Control Act, SMACRA, Control and Reclamation Act, that basically enshrined strip mining in law instead. And Jimmy Carter signed it saying, oh, I hate this. I mean, he really did. He said he didn't like it. And now, in 2012, as a result of that kind of compromising, guess what? We've got babies being deformed in the womb. We've got people dying of heart disease and endocrine disorders and pulmonary diseases and cancers because of political compromise. I understand the problem, but I also understand the political realities. And it's a damned slippery, hateful, the ground glass strewn slope. And everybody gets cut up on it.
And that's why so many people, they just flip over the board table. Because they get so frustrated. And that's the whole point of it, is to create this amount of gridlock and this amount of frustration that reaches epic proportions.
And we know that, for instance, Andy lives in a district, as I understand it, where there are three Democrats vying in a primary who will ultimately be the member of Congress, okay? Andy's working for one. Two others are running. One is more corporate than another. One is more progressive than the other two. But you know what? And I just want to say this. I'll take your leavings, Andy. Because I won't have, in my primary, I will not have a progressive choice on anything except for my county commission. It's going to be the same old tired pro-coal corporate Democrats that are on there every time. And I reiterate, you know, for those who think that I'm being an apologist for Mr. Obama, assuming that his name is on the primary ballot in West Virginia, I'm leaving it blank. I would leave it blank in any state where I lived. Because a primary is an expression of the will of the party. And to the extent that I'm a member of the Democratic Party, my will is to let the President of the United States know that I don't think he's progressive or liberal enough. You know, instead of hollering, you know, we need to primary him, instead of doing that kind of crap, if we had actually built a movement around the country to leave Barack Obama's name blank in every primary. Don't you think his polling people would be shitting kittens with crocheted tails?
They probably would be. And, you know, that's the other problem. We get so caught up in these little moments that we think, well, if we just get this guy and we just get this guy in the ballot and we just do this and we just do that, when really what we're faced with is we have to deal directly with a really painful reality, something really slow and dragging, and there's no glamorous visual that anyone has in their head that can contrast with that. You have to deal
with reality.
With that, yeah, you have to deal with that reality.
And here's another little slice of life reality, David, coming from our buddy Ray. Ray was in Michigan for a while. Now they're wintering in Florida. And he just wrote in and said, people who think that the Republicans can't win should spend a couple of days in Fort Myers, Florida. 75% of the cars in my neighborhood are new or almost new Cadillacs, BMWs, Lexuses, etc. For most of, and this is, man, this is the walk away phrase, okay? This is the one that's going to wake you up in a cold, beady sweat at 3 o'clock in the morning. For most of my neighbors, there is no problem except that Obama is in the White House.
You see, that's the craziness of this whole, of everything that we're going towards, where people say, well, I don't feel like voting or... I'll let people know something. You know, that sentiment that was built in Maine enabled us to have this crappy governor that is completely detonating and sabotaging and dismantling everything where it concerns public education and the federal government.
Yeah, it's well. And by the way, we have a new referent name. This one's really fun.
Yeah.
I told you the story about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the right wing having their hissy fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how we call Clarence Thomas Slappy?
Yeah.
Well, we have a new name. Clarence Pocket Fisherman. I love that.
that's a visual right there.
Have a Coke and a Pocket Fisherman with Clarence Thomas. Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah, back in the day. It was referred to as playing pocket billiards. Yeah.
But,
nasty old perv.
One last thing before I go. That's the reality what we have, and we have to deal with this. And you can't look back and say, you know, we're going to teach the Democrats a lesson. No, you're not going to teach the Democrats.
No, they don't learn that. No.
No. The best lesson we can teach our children and our children's children is to continue marching in the direction what we believe is the right direction to move.
Yeah, and don't leave for Portland, Maine from Oshkosh if you live in West Virginia.
Exactly, and don't elect a guy who is not qualified to be governor in Maine. It all fits together. That's what needs to happen. And yes, you know, here's the point. I understand there are Spider-Man comics. There's a choice between Spider-Man comics and there's a choice between Ghost Rider comics. And we love the Spider-Man comics. But guess what? They're all out. You're going to have to choose the Ghost Rider comic.
Right. Yeah. And just from a matter of historical perspective.
Yeah.
What you hear a lot is that there's no difference between, what have I heard him called? George W. Obama, Bush Light, Obama the Darker, or Bush the Darker, rather. And ultimately, the argument is there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
Ralph Nader made that argument to our eternal horror in 2000. But you know who the first person to say there's not a not a dime's bit of difference between a Democrat and a Republican? You know who the first person to say that was?
Who was that?
And just remember, every time you make that argument, you're making it alongside none other than George C. Wallace. Isn't that reassuring?
Yeah,
reassuring. He's the one who started that trope. Now, I agree that there's a political class and that they all behave in a certain way. No doubt about it. And I agree that there are Democrats who take filthy corporate money. No doubt about it. But the Democrats will occasionally throw us a bone. And, you know, sometimes it's a big bone, sometimes it's a little bone. You get better bones from better Democrats. The Great Society of LBJ, or the New Deal with FDR, those were better bones. GAFTA, NAFTA, SHAFTA, GATT, WTO, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, those weren't being thrown bones, those were being given the bone. I acknowledge all of this reality. David, it's good talking to you, my friend. Have yourself a good weekend.
All right, Bob.
Sorry about the beeps in the middle of the call. We'll have to get that sorted.
Not a problem.
Later. Bye now.
All right, later.
Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. And, you heard those beeps? I probably, Isaac dropped me a note and said, you know, I think I heard a couple of call waiting beeps. There's not supposed to be call waiting on these things. It's called a six-line hunt group, but arguably I shouldn't have been on the air tonight, but I couldn't stand the idea. After all that we've been through with the server hacking and everything, I couldn't stand not being on the air, so here we are, and as soon as the program's over, I'm going to, and I've already emailed saying, please make this go away, because that little ka-dink sounds like I'm getting a call from the moon or something. Couldn't be an interview with Newt Gingrich, could it? Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Not much.
The phone's effed up, but, you know, apart from that, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, I lost my earpiece. It kind of caused me a little problem here calling in. It's hard to listen between my computer and the phone.
Oh, that just creates cognitive dissonance.
Correctly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to save myself from getting cancer.
Yeah, well,
anyway.
Yeah, believe me, I understand that. I haven't figured, is Bluetooth cancer causing too? I don't know yet. I just know that I don't like holding the unit up against my head. It's creepy.
Yeah, nor do I. There's enough evidence out there that it's not healthy in the long term, for sure.
And there's so much of it that's so, well, I got started on a new cholesterol medication, and I actually did some research on it. And you know, what a filthy little corporate dodge it is. It turns out that it actually doesn't work. And it's not somebody else's study that proves that drug doesn't work. It's the drug company itself. They did a study and tried to withhold the data. It doesn't work. But, you know, anyway, you know, why don't you get on that? Why don't you take that? So it was causing headaches and just nastiness. So, no, we're going back to the other drug.
And one of those statins?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a statin that's mixed with another drug called ezetimibe, which was supposed to lower cholesterol in a different way. But when they did the study, Andy, they found out that, well, yeah, it does, but it also speeds up the accumulation of plaque in the carotid artery. I'm not in for that game.
Sounds totally self-defeating.
Yeah, I need all the blood flow I can get to my tiny brain.
Yeah, I just notice any time you're putting new chemicals in your body, you know, like anything in physics, there's always an equal and opposite reaction. It always causes something that just gets you into another realm of problems. Anything from the doctor that, you know, anything that's not natural that your body's not used to. It's just
right. So, you know, one of the things that I'm doing is I'm going to get on some fish oil and some linseed oil and, you know, stuff like, and try to handle some of the lipid issues that way.
Yeah.
But the best thing in the world that could happen to me would just be to lose 60 pounds.
Simvastatin is the one I actually do take that myself. It's on real low dosage, like 10 milligrams, something like that. And it seems to work. I have, my numbers, except for one area, are unbelievably great. And, that seems to do a nice job on the triglycerides and also keeping the cholesterol.
Well, see, that's my curse.
Anyway.
That's my curse, Andy, is the triglycerides. My cholesterol numbers.
Brings that up. Well, that's right. It brings triglycerides up to go down.
Yeah. And I have triglyceride numbers. Right. I have triglyceride numbers that make the blood drain out of doctors' faces. They go,
they can't understand why you're alive, right?
Yeah. And it causes things like
that reaction too.
Yeah, it causes things like pancreatitis and you know, the cholesterol numbers are generally good, but my good cholesterol numbers are almost non-existent. I think I've just got to start either mainlining or doing shots of olive oil or something, or you know, eating whole raw salmons or I don't know. But that, and you know, again, they keep saying, you know, hey, dumbass, if you just get out and exercise some, and you know, I'm saying, yeah, you go play in traffic with the coal trucks and get back to me, will you?
You know, I just know what you don't want to hear is when the doctor says, "I've never seen numbers like that before."
And I've heard that. I've heard that.
So have I. Oh, mercy! You know, I got you on the line. I want to give a shout out to Spike. Man, he nailed the Super Bowl on one of your programs.
Didn't he?
Ah, he called it. Spike's got the sports scene down, man.
Oh, Spike has hosted a sports talk radio program, and if some enterprising broadcaster out there had any sense, they would put Spike behind a microphone full tilt, full on, all the time doing sports. I mean, he's that good.
Absolutely. He's got a great radio voice, and I could tell that on your show, and I could tell that when I hear him on, let me get the door for you guys. Good.
Yeah, and he's got that whole PA.
He's on Rick's show as well.
He's got that whole PA, Eastern PA accent going on. I mean, he sounds legit.
Yeah, he's got a great radio voice, and you can tell he's a guy that's good. The way you tell football teams is it's how teams match up. You know, not necessarily do the records tell how they're going to do, but it's how teams match up man for man. And some teams just match up well against otherwise dominant teams.
And coaches.
It's how they match up.
And some coaches, understanding that, have another coach's number. I mean, the hoodie there in New England is, he's the Darth Vader of NFL coaching. But Tom Coughlin is apparently his Obi-Wan. I mean, he just owns him.
Yeah.
And that's so funny because Tom Coughlin has to take so much crap because, you know, he's sitting there working in the pressure cooker that is the New York sports media market.
Yeah, it's the worst. You're under a microscope all the time there. They take that. Well, you got so many bodies there watching every move you make, and.
Well, yeah, I mean that's why. That's why poor.
Fans, it's,
that's why poor little Eli Manning and I say that advisedly, at the beginning of the NFL season, said, you know, listen, I am an elite quarterback. You know, God, you're quarterbacking the New York Giants, and yet you still have to say that because all of the New York media attention is focused on darling little Mark Sanchez, who couldn't hit the broadside of a barn with a football, apparently. And, you know, the poor, long-suffering Jets fans, my apologies go out. But, you know, really, the newspapers were all Mark Sanchez all the time, and Eli was an afterthought, but Eli's got the two rings.
Right. He's one of Sandra's favorites, isn't he, Mr. Sanchez? But not because of his football prowess, I guess.
Right, right. Yeah.
But the other
good-looking man.
Of eye candy. Oh, mercy. You know, another thing, too, that you had on one of your shows, you talked about Dick Clark, and cause I haven't spoken to you for a while. But anyway, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and Dick Clark came up in the interview about what he did on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And it's so right. Michael Moore really nailed what Dick Clark was all about in one of his movies.
Yeah, with him driving away, flipping the bird.
Yeah.
Out of the limousine. Yeah.
Right, right. He wouldn't give Michael Moore the time of day. And Michael Moore just really exposed him in his restaurant chain, I guess, that he had in the Detroit area. And he was bringing in low-wage workers from the inner city and just really abusing them and exploiting these workers and not allowing them to form a union or not giving them good wages and benefits and really keeping them to a strict timetable that was tough for them to meet because they had to travel so far. Because he couldn't get suburban workers to take these jobs at these restaurants he had in these suburban malls. He had to bring in people from inner-city Detroit to abuse and exploit. And Michael Moore really exposed that big time. And Dick Clark did not like that at all. So he was exposed in one of the Michael Moore films. I'm not sure which one, but it might have been the one about looking for Roger Smith or something like that.
Roger and Me?
Roger and Me, right.
Yeah, that was his first big one. Was that what it was? Because I can't see it being part of Bowling for Columbine.
It could have been one of the Columbine. There were two Columbine films, too. It could have been in one of those also, but I'm not sure. But Michael Moore did really expose Dick Clark for what he pure one-percenter plutocrat, man. Just not into working people whatsoever. Anyway.
Yeah.
Not a good person.
No, and I caught some flack for that, for the suggesting that he's just going to kind of roll him beeping out like Captain Pike onto the stage. And you know, go enjoy your golden years, Dick. Because nobody knows who you are. I mean, I'm about the youngest generation that knows who Dick Clark is, and I'm 49. It's not a good sign.
Oh, man, you know, It's like in sports too. You got to know when to retire. I mean, like Jimmy Brown, man, retire at the peak.
Yeah, or
your image.
Yeah, Thurman Thomas. You know, goodbye now. And yeah, before you hurt your image, yeah, before you destroy your body. You know, Jim Brown is still around. You might not be saying that about him if he had continued to get his body beaten up. Yeah, that,
right,
you know, and
a guy like Joe Namath, who can hardly walk now.
Well, and look, I would not, for whatever money he's got, I would not take that amount of money to be walking around as Peyton Manning in 10 years.
Right.
Because he's going to be moving like a 75-year-old man.
Right.
And so, you know, the idea of him coming back, you know, I just hope Archie and Eli sit down after Archie's given him a good noogie. Well, no, it might hurt his neck. Just sit down, you know, listen, Peyton, you don't have to do it, okay? You don't, because it's not worth the cost that is potentially going to be imposed.
Yeah.
Because the Colts are just, and that's, you know, that's the other brutality of professional sports, Andy, is just like any other occupational enterprise in this country, they treat the workers like crap. Doesn't matter what Peyton did for you, what have you done for me lately, and we ain't going to pay you that kind of money, you and your crippled-ass neck. No, no, no. you go, you know, you go do that somewhere else.
Right, you're basically just a commodity out there.
Yeah.
You're just something, you're just a resource.
And that's why the NFL players at least made a clear statement about what they thought about Indiana's right to work law. At least they spoke up. Not that I guess it made any difference, but it probably made some people feel better. Let people know what side they're on.
Well, they collected bargain, too. You know, they'll be after them someday also. It's just a matter of time.
Well, lest we forget, the owners locked them out just last year.
Right.
And they had to go to court to get that broken.
Right.
And one of the people who went was, I think, Peyton Manning.
Yeah. Just another item, one of my favorite subjects, John Corzine, this MF Global continuing saga that goes on. I saw an article the other day. The trustee who's handling, trying to find this now it's $1.2 billion, of course, that they're looking for. You know, something you could lose every day. They will say the trustee who was looking into that was, they were consistently commingling their proprietary trading funds with their clients' funds. That was normal operating procedure.
And didn't you tell me that that's legal in Europe but not legal here?
Right. That $50 million or so was always getting mixed up. That was happening all the time. That's something that should not, that is illegal in the United States, but again, in Europe it's legal. But evidently they were doing it here. They were commingling the funds. And, you know, like again, where is the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission? Where are they? You know, they should have caught that. A failure.
Right. Well,
you find out that nothing's changed.
Well, it's like when you hear one of these cases come out, and God knows it seems like they're every two or three weeks, Andy, one of these cases comes out that says, 52 people have been sickened and 12 people have been killed because of E. coli tainted hamburger meat from the factory in Busted Knuckle, Nebraska. And the first question we'd like to ask is, Jesus, where was the USDA?
Right.
But there's an answer. The USDA was nowhere to be found because the USDA has been under assault for a generation now by the corporate proto-fascist bastards who want the USDA to, I mean, they'd like it if it was just canceled, turned off, walk out, turn off the lights, lock the doors, no more USDA. But barring that, they'll just weaken it to a point of absolute ineffectuality. And that's roughly what's happened with anything resembling oversight or investigatory powers on Wall Street, right?
Yeah, I'm with you. We've said this before. I totally agree. It's underfunded, understaffed. They don't get the money they need.
And it's not accidental.
Years. Excuse me?
I said, and that's not accidental.
Right. And, of course, if we had a transaction tax, if we could put a little 0.01% or so on every transaction on Wall Street, we'd have plenty of money to fund the SEC and to fund the regulatory bodies and the Commodities Futures Exchange. That would be all covered like it used to be. When the transaction tax first came into effect, up until the 60s or early 70s, we had transaction taxes that did fund a lot of the regulatory bodies.
Right, but because that's not a regressive tax on poor people, there's no interest, or not no interest, but it's long against it happening. And to use our USDA example, that's like suggesting that there should be a dollar per cow slaughtered. You'd have a pretty nice little
war chest.
Yeah, for the USDA to fund inspectors but you know, beef, it's what's for dinner, doesn't want that to happen.
Right.
And you know, that's I understand, Andy, that's one of your fundamental points of grief, as it is mine. Of the workings of this government. And the question is, if we start where we are instead of Oshkosh, how do you get that out?
Well, did you also see the article where Tim Geithner's advanced man, I think his communications guy at Treasury, a guy named Richard Seward, was just offered a job at Blackstone. I'm sorry, not at Blackstone, at Goldman Sachs. He's taken over, I think the guy's name is Von Prague, who was their communications media guy at Goldman. He's going to quit. He's been there for 9 or 10 years. And this guy Seward, who was the chief media guy for Tim Geithner, one of Geithner's good buddies, is taking the media job at Goldman Sachs. I mean, that's the whole problem. It's a total revolving door. If you want to work for these companies that we're supposed to be regulating, I mean, if you want a good job after government, you cater to these people, and basically you're working as a surrogate of them while you're in government.
Right, and there is that ongoing farce. I mean, there's supposed to be a waiting period, isn't there? Like 6 months or something after you leave a government job before you go to work, and there's the farce of cones of silence and walls of separation. And nobody, it's just like a politician's blind trust. Nobody actually believes that that's the reality. Because there's so much evidence in the corporate culture to suggest that it's not.
Right. It's just a revolving door. You step into government, you step out. You step into government, you step out. And you're not working for the good of the people, the citizenry, the common good. You're working for the corporation you're supposed to be regulating. It's a joke.
You know, that's like
a joke.
That's
been a joke. And that's one reason I really, after all this time, hate. I'm sorry, Bob. I do. I have this intense hate for Mr. Obama. I didn't mean to call him a dog. I mean, I was just using metaphor there because most of you say that saying that some dogs don't hunt. I mean, that's what
I
really meant by that. Where he doesn't hunt, meaning he doesn't go to bat for us.
Yeah, no, a dog that won't get off the porch, that's an old...
Right.
Yeah.
He won't use, like, the radio like Franklin Delano Roosevelt used with his fireside chats to keep on pulverizing the message home, because he could have a great bully pulpit. Nobody has a bigger bully pulpit in this country. Everything Mr. Obama does is broadcast all over the place, and he could do it. He could keep on pounding away, but he doesn't.
But you know what, Andy? That's interesting you would bring up that particular topic, you know, using the radio as a medium. I really think there is a learning curve there that should be addressed inside the White House communications team. But also, the president, what happened, and this is one of those goofy little history moments, we got the constitutional amendment that banned a third presidential term. We got term limits on the presidency because of the success being reelected that FDR had. Right?
Republicans didn't want that to happen again.
Yeah, and ever again.
Oh, what happened when he was in there?
Well,
man.
By the same token,
friggin'.
Yeah, by the same token, they saw also what happened when a president used the medium of the day. So I don't know what the exact history of it is. I don't know who first started doing it. But for as long as I can remember, if you happen to be a radio journalist and you're working a Saturday, all day long, you'll have 4 or 5 clips to choose from. President so-and-so delivered his weekly radio address today. And that is the media pigeonholing the president and taking that bully pulpit away, so that the guy who's working Saturdays has something to news read about. You know, there is a presidential weekly radio address. Reagan did it, Carter did it. I don't know how far back it goes, honestly, but you know, that's his time on the radio, and there's a weekly response by some designated member of the party that doesn't have the White House. But they could take a lesson with that kind of thing. Do you remember? And maybe not, because you don't pollute your brain with right wing radio. It was nothing during the 8 years of the Bush administration. It was nothing. It happened 3 or 4 times for the oxymoron Rush Limbaugh to say, "And let's go to Dick in D.C." "Hi, Rush. This is the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney." And it really was. And they'd sit there and they'd talk for 30 minutes or 45 or an hour like they were just old chums feasting over a corpse.
Right.
Well, I mean, Dick was feasting over a corpse. Obviously, Rush Limbaugh was eating boogers if you saw the photo from the Super Bowl.
Right.
But they did that. Now, when Bill Clinton was in the White House, there was no radio guy, with the exception of Malloy, for him to call. But now there is a pretty broad spectrum and growing every day, as evidenced by the work that Cliff Schechter and his team are doing in D.C. There's a growing body of people for the president to reach out to, and it doesn't have to be one of those staid, boring, dull-ass sit downs in the Lincoln bedroom or whatever that you see on TV. You need to hear a president kind of freewheeling and riffing, especially if he's smart enough on his feet to do it, which this president, like him or hate him, is. Let Joe Biden do the work. You know, he came out with a great off-the-cuff one the other day. He said, Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive. What a great line, regardless of what you think. It was a great line.
Sound bites play. Bumper sticker.
You know, so where's...
No question about it. Sticking to the Republicans. That's what they do to us with these sound bites.
Right, so where's that Joe Biden call to Tom Hartman? You know, bless his heart.
Bernie Sanders gets it. Bernie Sanders gets it. They have
exactly
Bernie.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders understands that every week. And you got to like Bush says, catapult the propaganda.
Bingo.
What Bernie Sanders does isn't propaganda. You know, the right wing understands that. They understand it's repetition, repetition, repetition. It's the Joseph Goebbels, Edward Bernays stuff. Repetition, repetition, repetition. Keep drilling it home.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, there's a reason that if, for instance, you tune in to Flush Flimball, he is literally still doing shtick that he was doing when he was a disc jockey in Pittsburgh, talking about the lady in Rio Linda, or with half my brain tied behind my back, or with talent on loan from God. He came up with those lines when he was a disc jockey in Pittsburgh, and he's still using them to this day because they create an identifiable moment, Andy. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And we
works, you stick with it.
We still don't get it.
And that's
sad. And frankly, the value or benefit of fearlessly fielding a few calls, you can't overstate the value of that. You know, let's say for a minute, just hypothetically, that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, went on Hartman's show. And let's say that we got that Andy from California managed to get in. Well, if you gave him 30 seconds of your best, Andy, and he responded in kind, I don't mean like, you know, screaming at each other or anything, but that would have a weight and a value of its own. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, actually, I've gotten on Hartman's Brunch with Bernie more than once, and I have been able to come up with some pretty good zingers to give Bernie. I mean, on free trade, I remember. I also did one on Obama with what he did with this spiel I have with the senatorial candidate that he's always back the reactionary, like Joe Lieberman or Arlen Specter and so forth, and
Blanche Lincoln.
I've gotten to drill that home, and Bernie's gotten off. So sure, that would have a great impact. Anytime you have a citizen coming up with some pretty good points that you don't hear in the mainstream media, people just don't hear a lot of these things that a normal citizen can convey. And if you do it articulately, God, you can really make an impact. No question.
Yeah, and you know, one of the
the citizenry do it.
Right, because where else is any politician actually going to hear the citizenry? There's, you know, I remember the story of, what was it, his first 4th of July celebration. W was in a rope line somewhere, and a guy said, a guy shook his hand and said, I just want you to know, I think you're a terrible president. And W's just moving along down the rope line, and he looks at him and says, "Who gives a fuck what you think?" and keeps moving.
Right. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. Hey, when I go to these open houses and I hear politicians talk, I don't want to hear the politician talk. I want to hear the people talk. And I want to hear how the politician reacts to what the people say. And I think that.
Well, and that's a, you know, that's a big part of the operating philosophy.
I can hear you talk all day.
Yeah, that's a big part of the operating philosophy going on here. You know, there's plenty of radio shows out there where people have Senator this or Congressman that. With very few exceptions, I don't care. Because I would far rather hear from Andy, I would far rather hear from Sandra, I would far rather hear from John, I would far rather hear from David or Juanita or any number of the folks, you know, Kevin in Colorado Springs. I put much more value on that because those are, you know, that's people like, because I'm not some elite guy who's getting $50 million a year. This is a bunch of working people talking. The same thing that goes on, you know, with Rick Smith. You know, a working guy behind a microphone.
Right.
And
you know, I know you wouldn't want to hear this, but a guy you think Obama would gravitate to, where you know he would get softballs thrown at, is Ed Schultz.
Well, sure.
Why?
Or Randy.
And get on there. At least it's right. Randy Rhodes is another one that would throw him a bunch of softballs. Hell, she does it all day on her show. But anyway, but hell, there are avenues for him to do that. But you know, he just doesn't want to alienate. He's just not.
Well, and that's
he's too afraid. He's too cowardly to alienate independents.
It's
by going with a so-called quote. You know, progressive talk show host, which is
but Andy, I would submit to you, I would submit to you that that's institutional, okay? Because that goes back a long way to the general negotiating from a point of fear approach that the Democratic Party generally has, because they're afraid.
Absolutely. But you brought up Dick Cheney has no problem.
Right.
Going on Rush Limbaugh's show any chance he goddamn gets. Probably he has an open call to get on there any second and knock off anything Rush would have on his agenda.
Oh, yeah. There's a one-button dialer inside Dick's coffin. You know,
they have the red phone there.
They just
you know,
put...
The special phone right into Dick Cheney to Rush Limbaugh so he can get his, you know, catapult that propaganda, but... It's unbelievable. Republicans have no problem doing that. But Democrats, no. Won't do it.
No.
Won't touch it.
And
pick up the bat phone.
And it's because they're afraid. They're afraid they're going to get called liberals. Well, Jesus, call me a liberal. Give me a chance to wear it proudly. Respond to it. You know, what did JFK say? And, you know, JFK was actually far more conservative than most people like to admit.
Call me a liberal, and I'm
but
proud of it.
Yeah, he said, I'm proud of it. You call me that. If by that you mean blah, 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 I'm proud to be
absolutely
one. In an instant...
The working class, bringing people out of poverty, call me a liberal.
Yeah, and in an instant, he completely turned that entire debate around. You know, by the way, since I mentioned JFK, and this is just one of those cultural things, I'm sure you've seen the story that's out there, Andy, it's been all over the place, and it's really disgusting. New revelations of JFK's teenage lover.
Yeah.
And I've
just seen the headlines. I don't really.
Yeah, I haven't either, bother. But it made me so mad. Because, now, I mean, I'm not one of these people who's opposed to finding out new things about old stuff. But that is not brought out to advance the cause of history. That in no way does that advance our knowledge of anything except that JFK liked to have sex. And I think that's already pretty damned well established, don't you? But there's...
Well, it's just another way, right, it's just another way to take away from his character.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea, to put down his character to make him look like that he was, just a sex maniac in the White House, just another Bill Clinton sort of deal to besmirch his whole presidency. That's the whole takeaway from whatever good he did. and the real things. That, hey, the guy got his head blown off for taking on the Pentagon and the Chief of Staff and the Cuban mob folks and the right-wing Cubans. He lost his life for that, for standing up
yeah.
for the United States, for the people. What more could you do to a guy? You took his life away.
Well, you know, now yeah, now they'll just...
Right-wing got their jollies. And life has never been the same in the United States since then.
No, it has not. I mean, that's our brother's Grokkigi moment, to go back to the go back to Roman history. That's where everything changes.
Right. They changed the whole course of history by doing that.
Yeah.
The whole course of history. Vietnam probably never would have happened.
Well, it's like talking about 2000 and, you know, what if Al Gore had become president? Because, you know, I've had right-wingers look at me incredulously when I say, well, you know, for starters, 9/11 wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And I believe that with every fiber of my being, understanding that I'm believing, but I think it's backed up by evidence. Because
right.
you think of that Hart-Rudman report that said airport security is so badly lax that something awful is going to happen. That was handed to George W. Bush within a day or two of him taking office. And he handed it, I'm not kidding, to Brownie. And it was never seen or heard from again.
Right, the horse whisperer, the total incompetence.
Yeah, my shirt was...
And the whole thing was a whitewash anyway. We don't know what really happened. All I do know is that we put a lot of money into defense and a lot of money into NORAD, and we have 60 fighter squadrons running around the United States, and you tell me that there couldn't have been more done when that happened, or more people couldn't have been on top of this whole thing. The whole thing was a total whitewash, and things happened within our government, and things happened with those guys in San Diego who the CIA totally botched up with the FBI, and the whole thing with what's her name up in Minnesota?
Oh, yeah.
The woman who had...
who was basically right, who was screaming about, you know, this ain't right, this is...
You know, let us into his computer, give us the ability, you know, the Fourth Amendment to break into his computer and see what he's got there and what's going on and who the other conspirators, co-conspirators are, and they wouldn't let her do it. I mean, it was just insane. The whole thing was totally botched. And, of course, that's everything dealing with Bush. It almost seems like it was botched so much... They wanted it to happen. I mean, they wanted something.
Well, and again,
ISI and Bin Laden and Pakistan. This whole thing is.
Well, and I go back to the.
Nothing adds up. Nothing adds up.
Everybody always talks about the presidential daily briefing of August 6th.
Right.
That's almost anticlimactic to me as compared to that report I mentioned to you a couple of minutes ago, because that thing laid out chapter and verse the failings of airport security at the time. The other thing that I find fascinating, and I gotta go out and find the name of this book because I've referenced it a couple of times. I've never seen any other mention of this incident anywhere, except that I've talked about it from time to time. And that is the speech that was given to the graduating class of 2001 at West Point by Paul Wolfowitz. The commencement speech. And in that speech, he says, I can't tell you what's about to happen, but all I can tell you is be prepared. And that was June the 6th, 2011. Just a little bit more than 3 months from the attacks on the Twin Towers. Now,
right.
You know, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of,
all you know is there was so much incompetence, so much miscues, so many mistakes. It's hard to believe that some of it wasn't orchestrated.
Well, you can't...
Some of it wasn't let to happen. That's the thing. It's you have to be a non-critical thinker, totally oblivious to reality, if you don't think that something was going on somewhere.
Well, and again, I've always
way,
kind of...
Way beyond where it should have gone.
I've always kind of prided myself, Andy, on trying to think about this, think about these issues in ways that others perhaps don't. And here's one of those examples. And that is this. We had behind us on September the 10th, 2001, we had behind us the experience of the what was called the hunting of the president, the miserable, tawdry business of the Lewinsky and Whitewater business, where a sitting president was hailed into a deposition, okay, while he was still in office, all right, and that was deemed okay all the way up to the Supreme Court, right?
Right.
And yet,
right,
when September 11th, 2001 happened, the 9/11 Commission cannot put any of the significant players under oath. They all testify by agreement without taking an oath, and George W. Bush, the President of the United States, is not allowed to appear in front of the 9/11 Commission without Dick Cheney by his side. Now, you can't take, you cannot take the deposition of Bill Clinton and overlay it with the way that went down and say that, you know, no, that ain't right. And you don't have to get to little bombs planted in the towers to say that.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's an empire. You said this time it's an empire, and the Republicans rule this empire, and it's a double standard. And, you know, what happens to the Democrats just does not happen on the Republican side.
Right, and that's right. My whole point. If that had been, let's assume that Al Gore becomes president and 9/11 happens anyway. Is there anybody in their anything resembling their right mind who thinks for an instant that the Congress would not have, by God, insisted that the President of the United States not appear before them in person, absent the vice president, and be sworn to tell the truth? Because if you can say any of that, I don't think you're operating in reality world. You know what I mean?
Right. Scrutiny would be intense. Nothing would be left.
There would have been impeachment proceedings.
Every rock would be turned over everywhere.
There would have been impeachment proceedings.
Absolutely. That'd been the first thing they would have done. Absolutely. Hey, just one more thing before I get out of here. Did you see the transcripts they came out with on Larry Summers regarding the stimulus package?
Yes, I did.
Coming through. That was just unbelievable to me that he admits that, yeah, we could do a $1 billion stimulus, but I wouldn't know how to do it. I have no idea how to put $1 billion to work. I can't even do $300 billion, which is what they actually did for actually reconstruction projects. He didn't even know how to use $300 billion in infrastructure. That was way too challenging. Way beyond.
I read that same passage, Andy, and on the one hand, it's possible to read it like, you know, what kind of godforsaken numbskull are you? And there's another way to read it where you say where the question is. It sort of presents an idea of the enormity of the problem. You want to get money out there doing things, but you don't know where to put it because the crisis, the collapse was so profound that it it plays into that whole I hated that phrase, shovel ready. Yeah, there was nothing ready. There was nothing ready for a shovel. And I'm not trying. Please understand, Andy, I am not trying to put everything off on the Bush administration. But this country had been broken into a million tiny pieces for 8 years. And for 8 years, nothing had happened in the infrastructure. You know, remember when the bridge collapsed in Minnesota?
Right. And Pawlenty and the boys don't put any money into the infrastructure.
Right.
I was just going to say, with Francis Perkins, and I think it was Harry Hopkins, was he under Roosevelt? I believe they were the people that just said, put people to work. Get them doing anything. Just build a ditch, fill it up, and then dig the ditch again and fill it up again. Just get people doing to build trails in the national forest. Do something.
I have never seen them, but
Bob is so far behind in everything, in infrastructure. There are so many rail systems in this country. The infrastructure, transportation, tunnels in New York. New York is a hellhole to try to get around in. I mean, all metropolitan areas in this country are so far behind. Airports, you know, the transportation system is a nightmare.
And an enlightened country.
I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Right, and an enlightened country is doing that design work long before the first cubic yard of concrete is poured. And that's what happened in those 8 years, is we stopped doing any design work, any front-end work, any skull sweat, because that administration was hell-bent on collapsing this country and watching the collapse happen after they had already left office and accomplished their goal.
Right. And these projects, big projects like that, building bridges, building tunnels, building mass transit, putting trains, cross-country trains in high-speed trains, will bring dividends and dividends years and years into the future with what positive things they do for our economy. Just making life easier and more efficient for workers and people and to get goods around this country.
Right, but there's a fundamental fundamental disconnect in right wing thinking, because they don't want that, because a lot of people have a hard time getting all the way to the ground on this one, Andy. Republicans don't want that because they hate this country. They don't like the Constitution. They don't like separation of church and state. They don't like the Civil Rights Act. They don't like the interstate highway system. The only thing they like is the military, and the only reason they like the military is because it serves as a life support system for defense contractors. And getting that all the way into the deep gray matter of one's mind is actually painful. I mean, you don't want to think that there's an entire segment of your country that despises your country, that at the same time that they, you know, go to war over whether you're wearing a flag pin or not. But I've been at this too long and paying attention to stuff for too long to come to any other conclusion. You know, you talk about making
I agree.
You talk about making jobs. I've never been to this part of Louisiana, but I'm told that in Louisiana there are bridges in the middle of bayous that don't have roads on either end. And those were ordered built there by Huey Long, because people had to have jobs, and he figured, okay, we'll build the bridge first, and then we'll get the road to them.
Right.
But people went to work. You know, I'm not 3 miles from a state park, and most of the state parks in this state were constructed by the CCC or the WPA, and it's that beautiful old mortared sandstone work using the local stone from around here. Mortaring it together, using logs for rails between the pillars, and it's gorgeous, and it lasts forever. And, you know, we didn't really need it.
Right, but it's putting money in people's pockets, and it's the multiplier effect.
Yes!
Like Eisenhower said, you know, you build one battleship, you could have built like 10 high schools. You're just taking away from the wealth of the people, from the wealth of the country, things that'll bring again dividends and, economic wealth going way into the future. But when you put it into defense, it's just like throwing it and flushing it down a toilet bowl, man.
Oh, and I go back to the...
No value given to the citizenry, to the country, to the economic well-being. And it's the economic well-being that really makes a country great. It's the economy and its people and how healthy and well they're doing that really makes a country great and makes you a force in the world. And I really believe, I totally agree, that the reason that the Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc went under is because of the great wealth of this country, our consumer goods, the goods we produced for the world just drove those economies into the ground. It was our general industry, our consumer ism and the wealth that we created within the people of this country that drove those economies into the ground, because people bought our goods. They were useful in increasing the efficiency and the productivity of people around the world.
You know, it's so...
The military, it had nothing to do with Ronald Reagan.
No, it's so interesting you mention that, because, well, the people who are familiar with this program will know that periodically I play Jimmy Buffett songs because I love Jimmy Buffett. Always have. Well, there's actually a live recording of his. I think he was in Cincinnati or somewhere, where he was just monologuing in front of a song, but it was during the days of the Cold War in the Soviet Union, and he said, "I suggest that we fly over the Soviet Union and throw $100 bills out of airplanes. Then we fly over the Union and Soviet Union, and we throw out catalogs to Victoria's Secret, Shorty's Pilot Shop, and L.L. Bean." and then we wait for the Soviet Union to collapse. Isn't that what you just described?
Yeah, basically. Because they weren't into the consumer goods or providing for their people. They made nothing. They drove themselves to defamation through funding their military and building goods that were no good, cars that didn't work.
I've got a straight...
That would break down. They couldn't build anything of quality. Well, we could in our electronics industry, cranking out semiconductors, the entrepreneurship here, the computer software, the innovations that took place. The Soviets couldn't, Eastern Bloc couldn't compete. Couldn't close to compete.
And so now that they've had a chance, once the Soviet Union went away, what happened? I mean, isn't Moscow the most expensive city in the world to live in now? I think it is.
It's up there. Well, they have their oligarchs. You know, they got their problems now.
Right, because they've got a class of people who are raking it in hand over fist and can't get enough.
Right. They want it all.
Yeah,
they
do. They do, and it's the absolute truth.
All over the world. It's not only a problem here of the wealth gap.
No, that's what I said. That's what I said at the beginning of the program. There is, global capitalism sees it really is a mercantilist viewpoint, Andy, where if you've got, and the key to mercantilism is to understand that if you have something, that means you can only have it at the expense of somebody else having less. And it really does apply to natural resources and non-renewable substances, and that's what you see in this devolution of capitalism that we're living in now.
Right. It's a zero-sum game. There are winners, and there are losers. And like what Louis Brandeis says, either we can create great wealth in this country, or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. Period. And that's what's happened in our country. We no longer have a representative republic democracy. We have guys, billionaires like Adelson, who's funding campaigns, just changing the total character of our politicals. It's so skewed to the top 1%.
That's another one of those moments where I realize I will never be rich, Andy, because I can't imagine being Mr. Adelson or that freak who's backing Santorum and having the kind of money where you can just throw $10 million down a South Carolina rat hole on Newt Gingrich's behalf. Because if I had that kind of money, I'd be broke in a week. But the fact of the matter is... The fact of the matter is, if I had that kind of...
You're worth a couple billion.
I'd buy myself a 125-foot motor sailing yacht and go out in the middle of the ocean and tell the world to F off. And just go from beautiful place to beautiful place.
Yeah, but they want it all, Bob.
Right. I don't have the mind for it. I saw an article on Alternet the other day that said it was some Wall Street trader saying, being a trader on Wall Street is about the most useless profession on earth. You do nothing except rake in money for which you did nothing.
Right. You're just moving money around. You're shifting money. In the Czech Republic, they call it ceny papíry. Paper money.
Yeah.
Stockbroker, a trader, ceny papíry, paper money, man, just moving money around.
You're just sitting
creating no value.
You're just sitting there dipping a toe in that algorithmic stream that runs on the internet, and whatever wets your beak, it just builds up over time. And the next, but
what you're doing is you're speculating. You're driving up prices or you're driving down prices. And what you hurt is the common man by doing that because you're creating nothing. But you're driving up prices or driving them down, and you're not holding product. You're not buying the product. You're not using it. You're just moving it around. Right. It's got to be regulated. So we need strict regulation.
And the question is, that's
funding venture, Santorum, it's something Freeze, F-R-I-E-S-S, Freddie Freeze or something like that.
Yeah.
He's a big mutual fund guy out of Jackson. Oh, he's got mutual fund operations all over the United States.
But he's also a trust fund baby because he inherited it. He didn't go make it.
Had been in a presentation. I used to live in Denver, and he presented a couple times with a firm I used to work for there, and I've been in rooms where he's presented. I'm not sure how he originally, but he had been really, now I forget the name of the funds, but he has a mutual fund family that at times has been pretty successful. But then again, that's, he totally distorts the political system with somebody like that. And again, that's where they make their money, trading, you know, getting back to this trading thing. What value are they really creating? He's moving money around.
Yeah.
A lot of it into his hands, distorting our political system.
Right. Well, it's all straight out of The Godfather. You know, I just want to wet my beak. And that's what they do. But instead of wetting their beak, they did dive in and get completely soaking wet from the top down. And the question is, you know, with for instance, with Mr. Obama coming out and saying, I would like to see a constitutional amendment fixing Citizens United. For him, that's fairly bold. Because
he said that, huh? I didn't know he actually came out and said that.
Yeah. Well, he said it. He said it in the context of saying, I am not going to unilaterally disarm in this campaign, and I will use super PACs. Because that had been a right-wing talking point. Well, you know, he's opposed to them. He can't use them. Oh, yeah, and he came out and said, oh, yes, I can. But he's been playing in his support for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. You know, he criticized Citizens United from the podium in a State of the Union address, and that's where that sorry, sleazy, slimy Alito hung his head and shook it back and forth like some sort of shaggy dogs. No, that's not what it means.
Sammy the Fish Alito.
Yeah, Sammy the Fish.
It was good of him to do that. Well, he's got to keep on pushing that. Keep on the message, man. Citizens United has got to go down.
And I guess just what I'm asking, Andy,
message,
is
Mr. Obama.
Yeah, can we give him some credit once in a while? Just understanding, you know, understanding the world of empire that we're in. You know, when somebody behaves like a Claudius instead of a Caligula, can we at least say, well, you know, we like Claudius better than Caligula. We don't want to see a horse led into the Senate. Although, you know, now that Rand Paul is in there, that may have already happened.
I'm sorry, Bob. He's been such a disappointment. Such a great disappointment. And I don't think we should... I really think the blame should be put on him for losing in 2010 and losing the House. The blame needs to be put on the leadership of the Democratic Party and needs to be put on him.
Yeah, well, look, I fault him.
He has disappointed... He has made it so it is impossible to get any momentum going on the Democratic side or people excited. He has destroyed that excitement.
Well, here's the way.
The blame has to go on him. It has to go on him and the leadership, and the leadership has to be removed. And that's how I feel, Bob.
Well,
He has to be removed.
Here's how I map that.
I'm sorry.
I understand.
I'm sorry.
Here's how I map that. I blame him for his cushy relationship with Rahm Emanuel. Okay, I blame Rahm Emanuel because Rahm Emanuel. Well, no, wait. I'm talking. You mentioned the 2010 elections, and I want to address that. Rahm Emanuel, before there was an Obama candidacy, Rahm Emanuel was full throated in his disgust for Howard Dean's 50 state strategy.
Absolutely.
And he went at it hammer and tongs. So,
right.
Obama sided with Rahm Emanuel, and consequently, after the 2008 election, Rahm Emanuel saw to it that Howard Dean was thrown out of the DNC and replaced with that pusillanimous little bit of nothing, Tim Kaine. Okay?
And how could he do that after Howard Dean was so successful in 2008? He was a major success. The 50-state strategy was perfecto. It worked. It was successful.
But Rahm Emanuel was given credit for it. If you go back and you look at the coverage, Rahm Emanuel was given credit for taking the House because he put so-called blue dogs in place in the South who could defeat Republican opponents. That he was... But then, in 2010, when it all falls apart, it's the same blue dogs that lost us the House, because people, after watching them for 2 years, said, screw it, if I want a Republican, I'll vote for a real one. And so that was just a massive, massive strategic failure on Mr. Obama's part and on Rahm Emanuel's part. But make no mistake that Rahm Emanuel was the driving force behind it.
I don't give Rahm Emanuel any credit, Bob, for 2008. I don't give him any credit for bringing in Blue Dogs. I give all the credit to Howard Dean.
I do, too.
And whatever the mass media or the corporate media says, I think they were dead wrong. Because I think Rahm Emanuel has always been a one percenter. He's been a Wall Street guy. He's been funded by Wall Street. He made all his money with Wasserstein Perella. He made like $18 million. He's Wall Street's man. I mean, this is absurd. He's not a man of the people at all. He put Gabby Giffords, you know, the woman that got her, unfortunately, you know, bad for, got her head blown off. You know, she got in office because Rahm Emanuel put her there, and Rahm Emanuel actually gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to a right-wing Republican candidate to run against her so she would win because he was so far out there that he beat the moderate Republican in the primaries in that district in Arizona.
Right.
But he gave Gabriel Giffords that seat, and you know where Gabriel Giffords came from? Wall Street!
Of course.
She was a Wall Streeter, too. She worked for one of the big Wall Street banking firms.
Well, you know, a Rahm...
You don't hear that, though.
No, a Rahm Emanuel or a one percenter in general is not going to have political colleagues who are working at Legal Aid in the Bronx. You know, they're not, because that's what that culture is.
Right.
They don't move in those circles.
Right.
You know, Mr. Obama was a community organizer in Chicago for a while, but that was there was much said about that during the campaign, but that had been a long, long time ago, and he had gotten significantly up the ladder since.
There was 10 years at the Chicago school in between that.
And see, that's another one of those things.
Indoctrination.
You know, Shakespeare said, "What's past is prologue," and you cannot work at the honest to God, you could not be a basket weaving professor at the University of Chicago, Andy, without being impacted by that filthy, the Friedman-esque economic model. I mean, the whole institution is utterly corrupted by...
Right. Hey, even today in the New York Times, if you see that article they have on education and how the gap is falling, now they see, well, income, people with higher income are doing much better in getting further education-wise in college and so forth compared to the gap that used to be between blacks and whites is kind of, you know, low-income blacks and low-income whites are kind of coming together. The gap is narrowing between the two, but it's widening when you look at the income disparities and forget about race completely. Well, they even have a quote from a guy at the University of Chicago. They got to put that in there. They go, let's not get too into income here. A lot has to do with parenting. It's the parenting you have to worry about. They had to get a University of Chicago economics guy.
Sure, and you know what? That dovetails very nicely with something that Jim just reminded me of. He said he had just seen it on PBS. The latest from the frothy mixture, Rick Santorum. Now,
right.
Take what you just said and hear this in that context. Rick Santorum is now running around preaching that going to college causes students to become less religious.
Oh, so, I wonder why. Maybe they actually critically think.
Well, yeah, the Southern Baptist Church proved that with their own internal survey a couple of years ago. But take that in the context of what you just said about, you know, that commentator out of the University of Chicago. Well, you know, if you're a parent, you know, if you're a really staunch parent, you're worried about your child's immortal soul, well, you'd rather they be dumber than a bag of hammers than to have them go to one of them heathen colleges, right?
Well, Rick Santorum also got on Obama because Mr. Obama wanted to be able to send kids to college, and Rick Santorum just thought that was a bad thing, going to college. You don't want to do that. Why do you want to go to college?
Yeah, except for the fact that he went.
Right. It's okay for him, though, right? Worked well for him. And also in that article, it just brings up how the rich people on their kids are spending like 20 times the amount of money to get their kids, you know, in K through 12, better grades than what low income pay. I mean, it's enormous amounts of money being thrown at kids in the higher income brackets. Can you tell me that doesn't make a difference? And also they say the kids from higher income parents travel so much more. They get exposed to so much more, you know, overseas environments and just libraries and museums, and they have the discretionary income to kids into so many other events and, you know, different educational type opportunities that it's just, you know, mind-boggling the advantages somebody with higher income has. I mean, it's just, I think that's why the gap is just widening. And, of course, we're not putting the money into the education in the lower income areas anymore. It's just, it's just criminal. The inequality, that's where the inequality in the whole Occupy movement, the inequality in this country has gotten to a point that's untenable. You know, it's just crushing us as a nation. Crushing us.
And it will have, and see, that's again, it's another cultural failure of ours to consider the long, you know, we were talking about the stuff, you know, the way you get something shovel ready is you have the design and the engineering going on in the front end. Well, it's the same thing with history. The things that you just described are things that we will not see the reaping of it in our lifetimes, Andy. But you know what? My kids and my grandkids damn sure are. And right. It is going to be hell on earth.
Well, again, you can create great wealth in this country, or you can have a democracy. You can't have both.
Yeah, I mean, consider...
You can't have both.
I mentioned it a couple of nights ago, that photograph of my grandmother as a child, 6 or 7 years old. It is a photograph of horrifying, grinding poverty.
Right.
And it's 1900, 1901. And if you think about what the 1% were up to in 1901... Well, the only reason they were able to be what they were up to was because a little 7-year-old girl was standing in front of a shack in West Virginia in rags. And that's the truth.
My grandfather had 6 kids to take care of during the Great Depression. Without Roosevelt and the CCC...
They died.
They starved.
They died.
They died, right? They starved. He had 6 kids. He had no... he was an immigrant. He could hardly speak English. Without the CCC, it's over. The only thing he had to make money was to get a still making vodka in the cellar. It's the only way he made extra money. He had no job.
Yeah, you know, our good friend Jude up in Washington just pointed out that the well-known list of the 14 characteristics of fascism, one of the characteristics on that list, and there's a very well-documented YouTube of Malloy reading it, and it's just stunning. But one of the defining characteristics of fascism, as Jude notes, is disdain for education.
Right.
Hello.
Absolutely.
Anybody?
Don't want people thinking.
Yeah.
Right. Don't want kids, especially kids in the lower class or middle class. Don't want them thinking. Don't want them critically thinking and to learn how to critically think. They might get ideas.
And those are dangerous things.
Ideas. Yeah.
Andy, have a wonderful weekend, my friend. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for letting me Bogart your time, man. You had me on for way too long.
No. There's nothing Bogart-y about it. It's an interchange. It's a conversation. And like we said before, I'd rather have this conversation than a conversation with some senator.
All right, great. And I, like I said in my email, I do value your opinion. You do a great job out there. Take care.
Thank you, Andy. Bye now. And again, my apologies for the beeps and the blinks. Jude also asking, was it the 80s when the Chicago school unleashed what Naomi Klein came to call the shock doctrine and brought people to their knees? Capitalism ran amok. It was another manifestation of it. Periodically, and the thing is, it's happened. It's like somebody coming by and putting a brick through your window. You know, if they do that and you put the window back up, and then a few months later they come by and they put another brick through your window and you put the window back in, well, eventually, and this is what has happened with Republicanism, eventually they just parked an entire truckload of bricks and started throwing them through working people's windows until we had no opportunity. We spent all our time ducking bricks instead of being able to replace the glass. And that, yeah, capitalism run amok. Exactly. Exactly. And the Chicago school, but it goes all the way back, you know, just go and Wikipedia Milton Friedman. What a disgusting, what a hateful, what a miserable, what a pernicious influence on this country because of the influence he has had on the Republican Party and on economics in general. What a, you know, there's a list of people, you know, you can, you know, better they had never been born. Milton Friedman's one of them, at least for most of the working people in this country, because among his theories of the fact that mistreating workers is not as important as the overall health of the economy. Well, that's how you wind it. Look, you want to see an example of Milton Friedman's economics in action? Look at Foxconn in China, where instead of trying to ameliorate the causes of worker suicide, they just put a net around the building that'll catch the suicidal worker so they can stick him or her back on the assembly line. Yeah? Yeah. And by the way, as soon as the show's over, I'm going to start getting emails off to get the beepy things fixed. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon or evening, Bob.
Well, hey, Kevin, how are you?
All right, I thought I heard my name mentioned.
Well, I must have conjured you.
Hey, Andy, just to let you know, I enjoyed that conversation between you and him. So I want to let Andy know I didn't mind at all that you kept that conversation going.
Well,
very interesting.
You can't get the value out of a conversation like what Andy was bringing to the table there, Kevin. You can't get that in, hey, well, thanks for calling to the program. Where are you calling from? What, busted knuckle? Okay, that's great. That's enough about you. Let's talk about me. You know, and that's the entirety of right-wing radio. All you get to do is get on the air and say, yeah, God, Rush, I just want to lick your bald spot. Yeah, that's all there is.
Yep. I didn't really have too much to say, although you talking about throwing the bricks through the window reminded me of a story of a criminal that decided he was going to break into a bank at night. And he winds up and throws the brick at the window, and the window returns it right back to him and knocks him out, which is where the police found him. And, you know, I was thinking during that story you were talking about, you know, we need some unbreakable glass there. But like you said, the bricks were just coming too fast and furious.
Yeah, all we can do is dodge bricks.
Yeah, well, no. There's one other thing you can do. Start throwing them back. And that's where I do agree with Andy to a large extent, is that, and where he feels a sense of betrayal, so do I, so do you. This president, in a lot of ways, has not stood up enough. He hasn't, you know, like he talked about being there with unions. If there's a union problem, I'll be right there with them with my walking shoes on. And we never saw him once in Wisconsin. Now, on the other hand, I agree with you. We do have to give him credit. I do give him some credit. But it saddens me that it takes a campaign coming up like this one is for him to start really talking some populist talk. I would have liked to have heard him do that 2 years ago. And yet,
well, and let me add to that, Kevin, I want more than damn talk.
Exactly, exactly. And I am very upset. I understand it to a degree. I can understand it, but I'm very upset about him giving in on this. As Mike Malloy calls them, pregnancy control pills issue.
Yeah.
Because...
No, you'd like to have seen a line in the sand.
Exactly. And because every poll I've heard come out says that even Republicans, I think you cited 1 in 5, something like that, but every poll I've heard of, the majority of people don't want to give up birth control no matter what the Catholic Church says. And that would have been a great line in the sand to draw.
Right, and you know, our buddy Tosh wrote in earlier today to point out there was a study some time back. He said he thought it was from the Guttmacher Institute that pointed out that the majority of abortions are had by women who already have children and who are actually in stable relationships. You know, so that means it is a considered choice. You know, not the scenario that the right wing likes to paint, where it's used by some poor slut to as a form of birth control. You know, that's some expensive birth control, as far as I know. But the other thing to add into this, you know, if you want an answer, Kevin, for why it is that the president can't do the bully pulpit thing, you know, I mean, he has a bully pulpit, right? Sure.
Yep.
But he's not on, and he is not on the TV 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so consequently, when we're talking about issues, and I think Mike is absolutely right, pregnancy control, you have to take this statistic into account, Kevin. In recent weeks, as this thing has continued to persist about contraception, news channels have had experts on to talk about it.
Yep.
Now, with the understanding that there are only two forms of pregnancy control available to a male, to wit, condoms and not doing it, the vast majority of contraception pregnancy control issues are leveraged by the female of the species. So the female of the species, who also has to carry said fetus to term, should she so choose,
mm-hmm.
has the greatest stake in that process. So how, then, can we square those facts with this one? Out of 146 guests who discussed contraception on cable news channels, 91 of them were men to 55 women.
Yep.
If you can square that up for me and make it make sense, Kevin, you're a far better mind than I am, because I can't. And the idea of, I mean, the very idea of having some priest opining about the decision of whether or when or how or why to reproduce is so foreign inside my mind as to make it incomprehensible. But never mind the priests. If it was all priests and all nuns, it would still be 91 priests to 55 nuns.
Yep.
So that do you see what I'm saying? That severely dilutes the power of any bully pulpit. You know, there's a big difference between Franklin Delano Roosevelt doing a fireside chat when every radio network immediately switched over to that, versus 2012, where maybe three or four news channels would carry the president, but you could still check in with the Kardashians, or see if somebody's yodeling on The Voice, or American Idol, or, you know, any number of the wide array of options that Americans have for amusing ourselves to death.
Yep.
So, I mean, again, it's just that... It's those reality driven moments that make things difficult for me.
Well, I tend to believe sooner than later, you're going to see the people rise up at some point, because I would say the majority, even of Christendom, as it were, has no desire to go back to the days of no birth control period.
No.
No, you know, people are having a hard time surviving on one or two, even two paychecks, so why would they want another kid unless it's planned?
How could this country even begin to cope with the population explosion that the removal of contraception would impose upon this nation?
Yep. Yeah, I was talking with someone the other day telling them my grandparents had 7, 8 kids. And that was the norm back then in the 20s and 30s. We don't have to do that anymore unless it's by choice. And that's what the great thing about birth control or pregnancy control is, that you get to make the choice of whether or not you want to have a child. And
well, and I just I mentioned an abortion being expensive contraception. Sandra was ready. I'm looking at a photograph here of a Louis Vuitton condom. It's just a condom in a Louis Vuitton branded wrapper. Care to guess the price, Kevin?
I'll say $20.
$68.
Wow. And it's a one-use condom, too, I bet.
They all are.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
$8 a pop.
Whoops. Yeah, and Sandra also notes, forget the University of Chicago. Try to Lenin, 1916, imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. Bang, score for the win.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope the people, especially once this stupid election cycle is over, because as someone said, I forget who it was, you know the Democrats or the Republicans aren't going to win this election. They know it. And
well, they're not going to win in the House, and they're going to and it's I would not give them good odds of winning the Senate. I still think that Obama has a decent chance of being reelected.
Oh, I think he'll be reelected. I don't think they will win the presidency. Yeah, the House and the Senate may be up for grabs, but even then, I think if people get, normal everyday people get motivated to go out and vote, and I think this pregnancy control issue has...
Maybe it'll blow up in their faces. I hope it does.
It has. I think it has.
Kevin, I got to roll out of here, but have a wonderful weekend. It's awfully good talking to you, and thank you for the help earlier today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And I am proud to announce, thank you very much to John for making the challenge. I am proud to announce that his challenge was met tonight, so we actually made the funding necessary this evening to meet one day's broadcasting. So thank you very, very much. And hopefully by Monday we'll have the telephone issues sorted out, and I'm going to work on the toll-free line. I promise you that I am. So have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this work. First of all, you who keep it all going with your kind gifts, as well as your ideas, your thoughts, your emails, your participation in the chat room. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, our moderators in the chat room, Lottie and Sparky. Thank you to our News Ninjas, Susan and Jean. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy, our op-ed columnist, Reverbo. Thank you to my head writer, David in Tennessee, presently enjoying a show I'd love to see, presently enjoying the Drive-By Truckers in concert in Nashville. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And, of course, thanks always go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Go there. Join the mailing list. Get on the mailing list and get yourself one of the coolest T-shirts in the world. Save the endangered hillbilly. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.